Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast covering last year's biggest releases this year. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and joining me are...
James Hunt.
And Reese Williamson.
Today we will be discussing, it's saying here, Director Not Found's 2021 record-breaking release, Spider-Man No Way Home. Oh, it's John Watts. But before any of that, I'd like to ask James to explain a comic book concept that I just don't understand. So, James, what I don't understand this week is, why are we being made to wait again? I hear there's going to be a whole 2 extra months until we can see Jared Leto's Morbius.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you guys what you thought was going on, because
I think they're waiting for him to win his Oscar before they release it, right?
Is he going to win an Oscar for House of Gucci?
It's possible, I think.
Is it? I've seen a lot of reviews that say he is in a different film to the rest of them.
Maybe he's in Morbius. Maybe actually you watch Morbius and you realise half of that movie, it's the same scenes as in House of Gucci, and he's like undercover. I don't know. Maybe.
The thing that I'm interested to learn is, can someone make a film about vampires that is good? And will this film get delayed another 4 or 5 months?
That's a very hot. Are you suggesting, James? Are you suggesting?
I was hoping to slip that one past you.
That there are no good films about vampires.
Yeah, no. Obviously, there are some good films about vampires.
I love it.
Not recently. When's the last good film about a vampire?
Let the Right One End's really good. Only Lovers Left Alive.
Only Lovers Left Alive is the only one that really counts, IMO.
I love the idea that there's a sub Morbius, like, first reviews here, Morbius sub review subhead. Morbius review. The first good vampire movie. I'm ready to see it.
The first good vampire movie since Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, since Nosferatu.
I wonder if they'll ever make a vampire movie based on a video game. Then we're really talking. I'm just looking. Jared Leto in the odds for best supporting actor is currently third in the odds.
No,
behind, oh my god,
behind Kieran Hines and Cody Smith-McPhee.
Well, we'll have to see how he does in next year's Cuppies.
And only behind, just. And then he's ahead of Richard Jenkins and Ben Affleck in fourth and fifth. Yeah,
amazing.
Those are numbers.
The other thing I was going to say is, if this film gets delayed another 4 months, I think it will beat New Mutants as the most delayed comic book film. So I'm sort of rooting for it at this point.
To be fair to it, there has been a pandemic in the mix here.
Didn't stop New Mutants coming out.
That was the perfect ending to New Mutants. Was
to come out at a time when no one could see it.
No, was to go through all of those delays. Like, say, like 2+ years worth of delays, only to be the first film to hit cinemas after the pandemic. So cinemas are reopening, and the only film you can see is New Mutants.
Could see New Mutants or Tenet.
No, New Mutants, I think, got like a week's jump on Tenet, even.
Also, James, you are forgetting the most delayed superhero film ever, of course, is Gambit, which they finally bring out this year. It looks like they've reworked it a bit, where Gambit now would, like, befriends a dog and, like, sort of drives the dog cross country.
Listen, don't.
But and they've renamed
it to.
We've
not got to our spoiler session yet. No, let's not reveal Channing Tatum's cameo in Spider-Man: No Way Home.
That would have been amazing.
He's in the mid credit sequence. So Morbius has been delayed. We added that in here because we just did a Hawkeye episode, which we put all of our news on, and also new release episodes. We don't do any news, so that was our only opportunity to tell you that you're gonna have to wait a little bit longer for Morbius, I'm afraid.
Michael Morbius. His first name's Michael. What a boring
name is Michael.
Sorry, Michael Leader, but Michael, I mean, it's just not a vampire name. Do you know what I mean?
You know what is a vampire name, and that's Morbius.
No, which makes they nailed the surname. A surname, retire for the day, you nailed it, and then Stanley or whoever invented him, you know, just could we have done better? What about, like, Victor? Or, you know, Smolensky? I don't
Victor
know.
Victor Morbius, that would have been good, yeah.
That would have been good!
Vlad Morbius, yeah.
Vlad Morbius.
You're right.
I just don't. You wouldn't have believed his pre-vampire story if he was. You'd be like, well, he was always going to be a vampire, wasn't he? Whereas Michael's the regular dude, Morbius is the vampire. Well, anyway, we're all looking forward to Morbius, which is in the Sony extended universe of Spider-Man characters.
The distended universe.
And because we're pre-spoilers, we can't mention yet whether Morbius did or didn't turn up in Spider-Man No Way Home. Should we move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of Spider-Man No Way Home?
Sure.
Okay, Morbius isn't in it.
Oh! And now it's time for the pitch.
Do you know who else isn't in it?
Go on.
Venom.
We will get to that. We will definitely get to that, James, although, as our listeners know, we'll have to wait a while. So, listeners, we're not doing a spoiler-free section because it's been a bit of a, you know, it's been a bit of a gap since this movie came out because it took me so long to see it because of Christmas and Big Pando. But now I have seen it. I managed as well, guys, to avoid just about every spoiler from this movie I think I could have got. I muted all of my words on Twitter, and that seemed to do the job. Like, I was fairly certain from the way people were talking around it that, in fact, all of the Spider-Mans did turn up. And also, you know, the size of the box office suggested that that was only happening for the Spider-Mans.
Yeah, that's a Tobey Maguire size box office.
But everything else I managed to avoid, which I was... Yeah, so I was relatively pleased with that. Should we start off with our kind of, like, broad reactions to the movie? Was your enjoyment, guys, commensurate with the size of this movie's box office?
for me, yes. I think this is my favourite Marvel movie since Avengers Endgame, quite comfortably. I think this is a Spider-Man nerd Spider-Man movie for so many reasons. And it almost single-handedly restored my faith in Marvel after some pretty mediocre releases for the last year.
Wow. I liked it, but not that much. God, I'd have to think about, you know, I found Eternals really interesting. I'm not going to lie. So, I mean, I have to think about that. But yes, it was great fun. It was full of not surprises because I'm a dumbass. I had read on Wikipedia the plot before I saw the movie because that's just my, it's who I am. That's my,
that's
my
your process.
Advice.
Yeah,
that's my process. Sure. But it's great fun. I think the pace is, you know, I've seen it twice and I felt like it's so, we'll talk about it, but it's sort of so there's such, like, really clear, not even acts, but like phases of the film that I think move quite quickly through their own phases, and so the movie does not feel long, even though it is long. I think lots of fun performances, oodles of nostalgia, a sort of an ending that was emotional. Although I went to it with my two sisters the second time around, and I know that, like, they were much more moved at the end than I was. I wasn't moved, and we can get into that, but. An ending that was, you know, very set for comic book movies often, you know, can't end, not just have bad endings, but like sort of literally can't end. And this feels satisfying. And in a way, you know, if we never saw Holland Spider-Man again, this kind of left you, I think, satisfied. It felt like it, and almost retroactively felt like it was telling actually a single story across the three movies to an extent. So yes, I do have criticisms. And you know, we shouldn't try and talk about this too much in this chat, but there is that, you know, the ongoing kind of thought thinking about kind of, are we happy that these movies are giving us what they're giving us, and maybe we should be wanting them to be more ambitious or not just sort of sugar, you know, do we want a bit of salt, not just sugar? We can talk about that, but so that's in my head as well a little bit, especially when the box office hits and does what it does. But overall, yeah, great fun, you know, laughs, excitement, joy, popcorn.
How many stars?
I'd probably go 4.
Okay, 5 stars from me.
Okay,
Joe.
Okay. This is going to be a fun podcast. I had two. I have kind of two takes in this movie. One from when I was watching, and one kind of since I came out of it and have been thinking about it more. In the moment, I think this is a far, far more competent movie than I was expecting, given all of the elements that it was throwing into it. Like, I thought it was going to be a hot mess. I really did. Like,
me too.
I said this on the podcast. I thought it was going to be a mess because it had so much stuff that it had to throw into it. I'll be honest. I think that it avoids being a hot mess plot-wise by cheating a little bit. I think it does some shorthand. It does some shorthand with its plot. It does. It does an absurd thing with the sling ring. Which I was just like, are you fucking kidding? I watched the most powerful wizard in the MCU take a whole movie to master this fucking sling ring. And Ganky's there getting it in 2 seconds accidentally.
Sorry, Ned, I believe his name is.
No, I'm pretty sure it's Ganky. And also, I think it cuts corners with its characterization of the characters it's bringing back from previous movies to make them work in this film rather than fully resolve who they are. I think that, you know, the clearest and most egregious example of that is Electro. But
egregious.
I think it applies to the Spider-Man as well. But, you know, in the moment watching the movie, I think it is kind of fun moment after fun moment. And like, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's a fun little reference. Oh, that's a nice little gag. Oh, that's, isn't it nice to see Andrew Garfield again? Isn't it nice to see Tobey Maguire? Wow, aren't Alfred Molina and Willem Dafoe really throwing their all at this?
And Rhys Iffins is there too.
Yes. actually, I'd love to know if he ever was. Genuinely, like,
genuinely, I'd love to. I couldn't tell.
I get the sense that that short shot of his face might be either archive footage or done.
Yeah,
in the
what was Sandman guy's
Thomas
name
Hayden well. Church?
Thomas Hayden Church. Not convinced he was there either.
No, but although that has more of a feel of it might have been a mocap performance than Lizard does. Yeah. So for all of that, I kind of enjoyed it in the moment, but I have felt and thought less and less of it the more I think about the movie, and it does ultimately feel like a bit of a hollow exercise to me. I think the returning Spider-Man work more on a meta narrative than they do actually within the movie. Like, it was, I felt like I was happy to see the actors Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire there more than I was like, oh, there's the Peter Parkers that I recognize, particularly Garfield, who I felt that just wasn't the same character. It was like, no, that is nice boy Andrew Garfield who wants a second, who wants a second chance at getting this character right.
And he gets it, and he got it, and it's good.
He did, yeah, I would agree with that. I think Garfield's good in this.
I think it's very important at this point to state that people should not mistake this performance by Andrew Garfield for the ones he gave in the previous movies.
No, those movies are still those movies.
Those movies are still very bad.
Yes,
we should not reappraise the movies based on his appearance in this one.
No, I would say that, just use this as an excuse to watch other Andrew Garfield movies, not Spider-Man.
Yeah, I totally agree. But also, I do want Amazing Spider-Man 3 directed by Mark Webb, 100%. So that I completely agree with you. But hashtag release Amazing Spider-Man 3, Webb, Stone, Fox.
No.
Danger Han. Bring back
just Emma Stone's corpse.
Yes. Oh, no, bring her back as Spider Gwen or some shit. I feel like I read that in some like six string comic book news website, and that's exactly the kind of bullshit that Sony execs would take from this success of being like, oh, I guess we need to just now get Emma Stone to be Spider Gwen somehow. Let's just make it happen, multiverse.
You are correct that is probably on their radar.
I think they would have to throw so much money at Emma Stone for her to come back and play Spider Gwen. I really do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they sell a lot of Sony iBos, I believe, so they got that cash. You know, they're making iBo money. Come on.
I mean, Natalie Portman came back for Thor, so Stranger Things has happened.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, I thought all of the Doctor Strange stuff in this movie was bad. We'll get into it. I thought Benedict Cumberbatch was bad. I hated all of the Doctor Strange stuff and the magic. I wish it wasn't in this movie. I wish they'd thought of a cleaner way around it.
Please, I think he's got to die. He's going to die in May. That's what I'm saying it now. He's going to die. Kill off Doctor Strange.
I don't think so. I think he's going to be your new Iron Man because
he sucks. They haven't figured him out. He sucks.
I agree. I fully agree. But I think he's the best they've got.
So I rated this 3 stars coming out. I think I'm closer to like 2.5, 2.
You absolutely in the bin, Joe. Jesus Christ.
I think it's good moments, bad movie.
No.
I think it's...
This movie, for me, is so good that it retroactively makes all the previous Spider-Man films worth existing as well.
Every single
Even the Amazing Spider-Man films, it gives them part of a larger narrative that makes me go, sure, those films are bad and stupid things happen in them, but it gets sorted out eventually. Someone was paying attention.
Does it get sorted out?
Yeah, because Andrew Garfield gets his moment of saving
someone he doesn't know.
No, saving someone who matters to Peter Parker.
See, in that moment, I think that was exactly what I was saying. I was like, oh, isn't it nice that Andrew Garfield is finally getting his hero moment as Spider-Man?
Yeah, it's great.
What I was not thinking was, that is a nice redemption moment for that Peter Parker.
I mean, the weird thing about that Peter Parker is that he gives that speech about how like he went really dark and angry off screen, and you're going,
no, that happened on screen. We saw it.
Yeah. A, that happened on screen, and B, this is what Andrew Garfield was feeling in between those two movies, like annoyed and frustrated that he'd been booted out of Spider-Man after two movies. But I was happy for him. Like, this is the thing. I can't divorce what happens in the movie from the meta narrative around the movie. For me, that is just the movie, right?
Yeah, I'm with James on this, Joe, and that's why I'm between. I'm not so, you know, splinker drinking the Kool-Aid as old James, but I do. when Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire appear in Spider-Man No Way Home, 2021's John Watts release, playing characters Peter Parker bracket Spider-Man, it doesn't matter. I don't think if you know, if you watched Amazing Spider-Man 2 an hour before you walked into this and you went, I'm not so sure that their mannerisms are the same. Like, it's the same character because, like, the movie tells us that this is Spider-Man from that movie. And so it is. That's the truth. That's the reality of the film. And then, I'm with James.
No, that's not how films work.
it is, though. You know, stuff happens between each frame of a film.
But there are so many legacy sequels or reboots that we choose to discount in our head canon because they're bad or they suck. And sometimes even the filmmakers decide that they want to discount them and not include them in the canon anymore. Like Halloween movies, right? That have just been, that we've now had like sequels that ignore different sequels and sequels to sequels that ignore, say, you know, it happens all the time. Just because a movie is saying this is that character does not mean when I'm watching it that I go, yes, I agree. Because for me, that was a fundamentally different character.
I agree. It is headcanon, but you know that's also true of sequels. You know, it's all headcanon between like frames of a film. It's all headcanon.
Yeah,
and I guess maybe me and James, we wanted to and could stitch the headcanon together between the Spider-Man 3 and Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Oh, yeah.
And fucking Marvel's Daredevil on Netflix. You know, we wanted to stitch it together and could enough. And I think the movie gives you enough to stitch it together. And so in my head, I'm not denying
your experiences here and, you know, experiences of our listeners watching this movie. I'm saying for me, I couldn't read that as the same character. I was purely enjoying the Andrew Garfield stuff on the meta narrative of Garfield getting a second shot.
For me, right? Again, I think everything we're saying sort of resolves with each other. Because for me,
yeah, we're fine.
Of course, it's the same Peter Parker. That's Andrew Garfield playing Peter Parker. Doesn't matter if his mannerisms are different. It's the same guy. And like he was Peter Parker. Like he made different choices and he gave a different performance. Yeah. I think Joe is saying like he doesn't believe that is the same guy.
No, I think it's just that, the same actor playing
a different version of the guy. Right?
I think that's the Peter Parker that Andrew Garfield always wanted to play but wasn't able to in the Mark Webb movies.
Yeah, but like I say, for me, like it's Andrew Garfield playing Peter Parker. It doesn't matter what's in the text. Like, what's on the screen is that guy playing that role.
Mm.
It doesn't matter to me if they line up because it's manifestly like Andrew Garfield's history as Peter Parker exists off the you know, quote unquote page of this movie. Regardless,
it's funny that we're arguing about the Andrew Garfield of this because I think the more egregious return is Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man who.
I agree with that.
He doesn't get a moment. He gets stabbed for no reason.
He gets a great moment, which is that he stops Tom Holland from beating the shit out of Willem Dafoe.
Another moment that I just thought was absurd. I could not buy into. Okay, so I'm going to say something else. I think Tom Holland's bad in this movie. I don't think he's been bad in the previous two. I think he flubs.
He has
most
been
of
bad
this.
In the previous two.
I think weirdly. He... See what else I can say for someone to disagree with. I think weirdly he and Zendaya on screen have like no chemistry.
No chemistry at all.
I don't buy that relationship.
You are killing me.
I thought splintering her off with Genki was a bad idea because they don't have any like comedic chemistry either. And
yeah,
I think the big mistake that this film makes for me in terms of that final moment where Tom Holland Spidey is wailing on the Green Goblin. Is that shouldn't have been the Green Goblin that he was wailing on. If this film, rather than having a Doctor Strange in it who causes everything, has a villain in the centre of it who is unique to the Tom Holland franchise, who is pulling the strings and is unique to Tom Holland, and brings all of these other bad guys, and maybe we didn't need one villain from every other movie, maybe we could have cut Sandman and Lizard, right? Maybe we could have not brought those two back because no one's getting it. They didn't add anything to the box office here. We didn't need to bring them back. What if there was a villain from this universe who Tom Holland blames for bringing these characters back that result in the death of Aunt May, and that's the person that he's wailing on? But it doesn't make any sense that he's beating the shit out of Green Goblin. It just doesn't.
The reason he's angry is because it's all on him. That's why he's letting go of his strength. Like, that's why he's wailing on Willem Dafoe, because he's angry with himself.
Yeah, but
and he's just like, this is all my fault, but you're the only guy here I can beat the crap out of.
But that character is arriving, as they all do, with so much baggage attached to a different character.
Yeah, fair.
And I just think I would have loved to have seen a version of this movie that had something tangible for the Tom Holland Spider-Man to be gripping onto. Because, you know, when we talk about those first two Spider-Man movies, the reason they're so good is because of Maguire's personal connection with those antagonists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the one thing that the Amazing Spider-Man movies get right, is it tries to establish that connection between Peter and the antagonist. It just does it.
Fails.
It does it whilst having a Peter Parker who doesn't actually care. But, you know, it attempts to do it. And, you know, that's why I think, you know, that's still the single best moment in the three Tom Holland Spider-Man movies is the Michael Keaton driving him to prom, where suddenly you're like, oh, holy shit, this is a great setup for your hero and your antagonist. And
I think
that's lacking for me here. It's really lacking for me here.
I do think Michael Keaton should have been in this movie, because he makes a lot more sense than almost any of the characters they actually put in it.
No, but James, he was too busy. He was shooting Morbius. He couldn't. He couldn't get to set. I'm sorry, bud.
Yeah. It does feel a bit like the reason they've got so many villains is because Sony went, we want our Sinister Six movie.
They weren't six of them. You got so close to the Sinister Six, and I assumed, I'm sure you guys did as well. I assumed, there's five of them, there'll be a six, because these guys, these guys seem to want to make a Sinister Six movie since like 1703, so there'll be six of them.
Yeah.
And then there wasn't. I'm
confident there was a draft of this. I'm confident there was a draft with six people in it. Six.
Maybe they're specifically not so they can do a Sinister Six movie in the future.
It is that, isn't it? God damn it. This is the fear.
We have to have less than six because we want to use this idea in the future.
I want to pick something you said.
Can we?
Joe.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I'll make one, which is that you said the reason that those Spider-Man movies are good is because he has a connection with the villain.
That's a reason. Yeah, that's fair.
And I think you can look at, you know, there are lots of superhero films and lots of action films, blockbusters, where, you know, they are good and regarded, and you have fun with them, but they are good and they are doing interesting stuff. And the relationship between, you know, a protagonist and antagonist is a bit more generic. And I don't even think that you have that here. You do have, you know, he kills, the Green Goblin kills his family, kills Aunt May. That's, you know, that's almost the biggest hurt you could put on Spider-Man.
I think that's a bad choice to make, that the Green Goblin who's doing that.
Except the Green Goblin is Spider-Man's biggest, you know, greatest enemy. And I kind of really dug that by the end of this movie, the greatest kind of hurt on Peter Parker that probably he'll ever experience, the death of his close family, his Uncle Ben equivalent, his Aunt May, was perpetrated by his greatest ever villain, Green Goblin. I kind of, you know, they the way they got there, you know, I kind of, it's, I, there's an elegance to it within the canon of this character's franchise. I know that sounds,
but they do also do a lot of work to build up the relationship between Willem Dafoe and Tom Holland. Like, it's not like it comes out of nowhere.
But so it's also why I think the moment at the end, why I don't think that works as a moment for Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man. The moment for Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man for me should have been saving Doc Ock. That was the one that, if you said to me, like, what's the thing that feels unresolved from that franchise? It was like, well, that's the guy he could have saved. Because again, like, I don't think this Green Goblin in the first Spider-Man movie is pretty much full evil by the end of the movie. It's, you know, it's on the Gollum scales, he's pretty much Gollum for the majority of the back half of that. It's like he's losing his grip on Norman Osborn the longer the film goes on.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, the Doc Ock one, and you know that he's not a great guy to start off with either, Norman Osborn. That's the other thing about that franchise. Whereas Otto is genuinely kind of like a good dude.
He's made insane by the AI of his tentacles.
Yes, it's just that. It's just
regardless
that
of how little sense that makes.
You hear that, Elon Musk? AI. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, I really struggled with the final act of this because I wasn't buying the emotional beats. I thought it was one of the worst looking Marvel films. I thought the action was so muddy. Like, for all of our complaints on Disney Plus that they've been setting their fight scenes in warehouses, I thought it was really bold for one of the biggest blockbusters of all time to have a fight around some scaffolding, because that's what that final sequence is. It's not the Statue of Liberty. It's not. You don't see the Statue of Liberty. It's scaffolding.
I mean, Spider-Man.
I do wonder whether the Marvel, the unfortunately, and I'm not, again, I'm not disagreeing. What did you say, Anna? I'm not disagreeing with your feelings, Joe. But I just wonder whether the Marvel movies are proving year after year that sort of interesting action cinema is driving further away from sort of action blockbusters. Yeah. It's like it doesn't seem to matter. I don't think my sisters, who are both younger than me and obviously not like stupid ass nerds like me and you guys are, but you have seen various Spider-Man movies, etc. Like, you know, they aren't. I don't wish to speak for them, but I'm telling you, and I will speak for them. They aren't sat there in that last sequence thinking about the action. They are thinking about the character moments between the three Spider-Men, Zendaya, Genki, the five villains. That's the stuff that, and then it, almost the action, the fighting, the punching. It's just, it's these sort of moments in between the character beats. And in a way, it's almost like this flip of how action cinema kind of, why it even existed in the first place, which was, oh, well, the kind of character bits, the story is just going to get us from action sequence, from one action sequence to the next. This is the flip of that, it feels like, in some ways. And it's something to put in the trailer, and it's almost spectacle, not action, in some ways. And that's just, and I'm not denying your experience. I have the same experience if I think about it too much, but it doesn't seem to care. It doesn't seem to matter to people, and they don't, and they're not looking for that from these movies.
I was going to say, I've been well out in front of that, in that. Even watching Avengers Endgame, there was part of me that was like, I just don't have this fight sequence, and let's get to the bit after Thanos is dead.
Right.
But cinema's a visual medium.
No, but the talking is the fun bit.
You want to see the toys, you know, sort of talk to each other and kiss?
Yeah, a little bit, but here's not for 45 minutes.
Okay, right. Forget a broad action scene. Forget a competent action sequence with geography. What I want in a movie that has three Spider-Men is an iconic shot with the three Spider-Men.
It's the Hulk. You get it with the Hulk.
The final. No, but the final. Yeah. No, right.
With the pointing.
The three. I need the three Spider-Man. I need the three Spider-Men swinging through the air and visible, and where I can tell which one is which without having to have a close-up on their face. Like, I thought that third act sequence, I was genuinely tearing my hair out, going, "This is so bad."
I agree. It could have done with an Avengers like panic tracking shot like they had in that movie, but I was fine. Like, for me, the iconic moments in this film are the character moments. Like, you know, that bit of Tom Holland on the roof and the other Spider-Man turning up and you're seeing them in like silhouette on the roof, I fucking loved it. I don't care that they probably weren't even there.
Can I sort of cycle? I don't know if we plan to go through the movie chronologically. We normally do.
Yeah, we will to an extent. Yeah,
I just wanted to make a comment on the Joe side of the argument, which is, I think the biggest problem with the movie is the Zendaya and Peter relationship, or lack thereof, i.e. you are supposed to really feel, you know, because remember, the movie kind of doesn't end with the big multiverse stuff. That happens at the end, but then the movie really ends with the whole memory wipe thing. That's supposed to be the emotional kind of crux of the movie, what it's all been building to. And I think the key it's such a problem that I didn't really care that much that at that point you got the only people that know him at that point in the movie are Stephen Strange, who's been a bit of a dick to him, so give a shit. Genki, Zendaya, and Happy, right? Who's barely been in it. So you're talking about Genki and Zendaya, and I think Jacob Batalon, for all his, you know, positives, I don't think he's a very good actor. I don't think he's very charismatic. I'm not invested in their friendship at all. And then you have the key bit, there's Zendaya and Peter Parker, and in sort of movie time, you know, they only really got together at the end of the previous film. And they barely spend much of this film together. And so I just really wanted to feel more when that final kiss came and he went to visit her in the diner. I didn't really feel much at all.
My take on this relationship on screen? I can completely see why this relationship would resonate with a teenage audience. Because to me, it does feel like two characters and two people who don't really have anything in common, don't really have any chemistry, but fancy each other quite a bit. And they're 18, so it feels like the most important, I can't lose this person, love of my life. But when they walk, when Tom Holland walks into the diner in the last scene and he's like, oh, hey, and it's like, yeah, they're just any two kids. They're just any two kids who don't matter. Like, I'm not watching that going, oh my God, this couple that are destined to be together. Now, when I was thinking that was when I was watching Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst. Now, I don't know if they had any chemistry. I don't know.
They did not. For the avoidance of doubt, they did not.
But I was fucking 14 watching that movie, and they'd done an upside down kiss in the rain, and I was like, oh my God, these people need to be together at the end of that movie. How can they walk away from each other? They're perfect. I completely understand, you know, how it might be working for people. I think it's flat out insane, James, that you think you've got chemistry. you're a grown-ass man.
I think
you're fully 20 years older than Reese and I.
They are both.
You're 40.
They are both good comic actors. And that's all I want out of any relationship. I just, if they can, they can spark off each other and be funny in their own ways, which they can. I don't care if they are just like visibly horny. That doesn't worry me.
Well, they're not going to be visibly horny in an MCU movie. do you, here's a question. Talking about the meta narrative of this movie, do you believe they're in a relationship in real life?
In real life? Yeah.
I don't believe it for a minute.
The thing for me about that relationship, right, is that when we get to the end of the film and he makes the decision to walk away, the overwhelming feeling I got was that is the right choice. Please don't undo it in the next movie. I have these like really horrendous visions of like Tom Holland meeting Jacob Batalon and them doing the like him trying to be like, oh no, we were friends in a previous life, you have to remember, and then doing the handshake thing and he's like, oh wait, the handshake, I remember. And I just like, I don't want to see that. Those characters are done. Bring in new Spider-Man supporting characters.
I got good news for you on the Jacob Batalon front. He isn't going to be in any more of these movies.
But like Zendaya as well. Like I think
Zendaya is going to be in more.
I think that character, they resolved it well. I sort of, you know, perfect ending for that phase of his life. Let him move on. Part of the Spider-Man story engine, right, is that it was for a big chunk of its initial run, it was actually a romance comic that had a superhero in it, and he was constantly like switching between different partners, different love interests, and you know there was a will they won't they with Gwen and Mary Jane and stuff, and like
Gwen and Mary Jane,
but you know a love triangle, you know, okay. Betty and Veronica Archie,
calm down
thing.
calm down
a very different comic being made.
Calm down, what is this, like, Mark Millar's Trouble? I don't know.
But like, that's the sort of thing I want them to do in the next film. I have no doubt that they're going to bring back Zendaya and memory wipe her. But just for this bit, let me hope that that relationship is as much as I enjoyed it, as much as I enjoyed Zendaya.
It's weird that that's a multiverse. That's a hanging thread that they've got in like multiple franchises now of like with the, between this and Guardians of the Galaxy of we were in a relationship, but you don't remember.
Yeah. I mean, that's more a sort of, that's a problem with scheduling more than anything, right? Because that should have been resolved by now.
Okay, hot take. The next Spider-Man solo movie will at the start feature a conversation between Peter Parker and Chris Pratt, Star-Lord, and that's what it will be about. Star-Lord having resolved that issue with Gamora in Guardians 3 and Spider-Man yet to resolve. There you go.
I mean, the thing is, I was reminded of Man of Steel at the end of this movie. Was it Man of Steel? No, Batman v Superman. Where, like, the shot of Tom Holland, like, on his own in the world with a police scanner and a costume and a crappy little apartment that looks like his apartment from Spider-Man 2. Just being like, okay, I've got my mission. My purpose is clear. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to be the best Spider-Man I can be. No gimmicks, no assistance.
I'm going to be the very best.
And I was like, show me that movie next.
Yeah, I would prefer to see that.
I don't think we're going to get it. I think really they put it in a place of, well, we can do one without Marvel if we want to, because no one remembers him, but they'll re-sign a contract and they'll bring back all the people and all the bullshit and he'll be back in the Avengers. And
oh, God. We'll probably love it.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that, but that's a great
point. But of course you're right.
Genuinely, did you not? Yeah. The whole ending of that movie, I just went, well, Sony clearly said this is where he has to end up in case this deal doesn't happen. To set him up
for like 20 more movies where he never interacts with a single character from the MCU because they don't know who he is. Of course, genius, James.
I know we joked about this at the start, but Morbius has Michael Keaton in it, so they're doing something there with, unless that is, you know, that universe's version of the Vulture, but
yeah,
I don't know.
My take is characters will still remember Spider-Man and Spider-Man existing, but they just won't remember Peter Parker was him.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah,
I guess, ultimately, part of my problem is I don't care. Part of my problem is I come away from this movie and, you know, I have struggled with this franchise in the MCU for as long as they've been doing it. I think my favorite is still the first, which is a movie I'm lukewarm on. I think I got to the end of this. Like, I love doing the MCU speculation with most of the franchises. I find it really difficult to care about what's coming next with Spider. And that's such a weird thing because I really like the character of Spider-Man. I've failed to invest with this franchise. I don't think it's for me though. I do think of all of the MCU franchises, I don't think this one is for me.
Well, it seems to be for most other people in the world.
I think it's for people younger than me and James. Mm.
I mean, but Joe, the box office disagrees with that.
Yeah,
idea, yeah, I think the box office goes, no, this is an Avengers Infinity War. This is a Star Wars Force Awakens level four quadrant, you know, commercial, accessible, smash fucking hit, baby. and so, yeah, not just James and kids, unless James and the kids have seen it a whole lot of times. They're like, they've seen it. I've seen it 50 times.
One more question before we get into some of the plot specifics.
I have a question too.
It was one of the questions we were asking before this came out, and I've not really seen many people mention it since the film came out, which makes me think it ultimately wasn't a problem. But did comparisons with Into the Spider-Verse not cross your mind at all watching this, or give you any pause watching this?
I can see the confluence, but I think this was a different beast. This was more a celebration of the cinematic Spider-Man over the last 20 years. And specifically that.
I mean, perhaps, maybe this is Sony planning things very smartly. But actually, you know, I'm not sure there's a single character in Spider-Verse that particularly resembles any characters in this or any of the, you know, any of the characters in the MCU Holland Spider-Verse. And so that helps. And also, you know, and so, and particularly, you know, there's, I kind of thought Miles Morales would find his way into this, but that didn't happen.
There's a reference, right, isn't there?
Barely a reference. Yeah. And the other thing that everyone remember, you know, that is so wonderful about Spider-Verse is all of the trippy action stuff, which again, I thought we might get a bit of in this, you know, the sort of multiverse of it all, but actually I think we were all probably overthinking the multiverse pre-release. We were, you know, speculating, oh my God, what, No Way Home, what does that mean? Does he get trapped in a different universe and he has to fight his way out and he's in an alternate reality? And actually, you know,
the title has nothing to do with the film.
It doesn't. And maybe this ties into, and I kind of agree with you, Joe, earlier when you said, you know, the kind of the sweaty way of getting to the premise. It is, and the, you know, the strange of it all. It is very sweaty. It is, and it's kind of, if you think that the sequence, we'll get to it. The sequence when he's doing the spell, that really hit hard, particularly the second time I saw the movie. That sequence where he's, you know, doing the spell and Spider-Man's asking for things, and then at the end, that's the kind of, essentially that's the premise of the movie. That moment that creates the issues. And like, it's ridiculous. Both those characters are acting so dumb in that moment, and which causes all the problems. And actually this, again, the kind of, there is no Spider-Verse kind of, you know, flashy portal teleporting shit and it's different timelines. It's not that at all. It's much more pedestrian, and that makes it probably more accessible to a, you know, $1 billion audience. I'm sure it does, but. And also the benefit of, you know, it not reminding you too much of Spider-Verse, but it also makes it a bit sweaty and a bit pedestrian. But maybe we can talk
about that. And I think, we were obviously debating before the movie, based on the trailer, whether this felt like it was actually Doctor Strange. And I think I came away from the movie going, that's the Doctor Strange that I saw for most of his solo movie. I kind of felt like the Doctor Strange that we were presented with across Infinity War and Endgame was a kind of Doctor Strange
who matured
yeah. and would, yeah, had yeah. kind of embraced this
statesman.
This more Zen version of the character, this more ancient one version of the character. And he's not in this film. And I kind of felt like, prior to this, like, oh, the one element of Doctor Strange, the solo movie, that I didn't like was Cumberbatch's character. You know, I didn't like that. That was the thing that I thought, that still needs work. I like the movie you're in more than I like the character. And then I thought, oh, they fixed him. They figured it out in the, you know, in the crossover movies. And then here he is back to that previous version.
It's because he's been demoted.
Well, I was going to make a joke that maybe he gets back from the blip and he's all mature and stuff, and then he's sort of, Wong, how you doing, Gray? It's so, I'm back, the Sorcerer Supreme's back, and he's like, oh no, I'm the Supreme now. And then Strange's like, oh, I'm throwing a hissy fit now. I'm throwing all my toys out of the pram. I'm a kid again.
I tell you something that I thought was interesting was that they changed the scene that was in the trailer in the movie. Like, in the movie, Wong is a lot sort of angrier, and he's going, don't cast that spell. And in this one, he's like, I can't remember what he says, but he's like, oh, I'm going to keep an eye on you or something. And it's a much softer.
He kind of says, like, oh, do whatever.
Do whatever. Just keep me out of it. Yeah. It's really interesting that they softened that moment to presumably try and make Doctor Strange seem less insane.
He's a dick through this entire movie. And, you know, like, they were trying to replicate the Tony Stark of Homecoming, they're probably in the movie a similar amount. He kind of chastises Peter more than he encourages him. I just thought that, like, in this movie, it is obvious that all of the problems are kind of Doctor Strange's making.
100%.
That he does fuck up the spell. And then, like, if he's like, oh, here is this kind of colossal multiversal threat that needs sorting out, Like, it feels less like jokey Iron Man jetting off to a wedding in the first Spider-Man, because there isn't really any big thing going on that he needs to be sorting out. It's like, no, Doctor Strange should be around helping. In the narrative of this movie, he should be around helping. And then, you know, like the whole fight sequence in the middle of the movie between the two of them. Like, I think, you know, we're clearly supposed to be on Spider-Man's side. That is the that's the great power, great responsibility thing, right? Is that we need to be on the side of these villains are for saving, not for killing. But how insane that one of your, you know, your banner superheroes in the MCU is going, he literally says, doesn't he, like, some of them just need to die. Like, he's like, yeah, sometimes people just, that, you know.
No, I can sort of buy Doctor Strange's impulse being, let's not interfere with reality because we screwed it up once already. And Peter Parker's being, no, we have a moral duty. Like, it's a different scale problem, isn't it? Like, Doctor Strange, I don't think would be worried about individual lives because he's focused on the big picture, whereas Peter Parker is very much friendly neighborhood, down to earth. This guy shouldn't die just because he got electric powers. And he is correct in that.
I came out of this movie, you know, wanting to see the next Doctor Strange movie less than I did before. You know, because I was this character was so much less fun in this movie than he was previously.
That's because he's like, he's an adult in a film that is about kids, right? He's the authoritarian figure.
I mean, I don't think they would do this, but I would fully love if you come out of Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, not with a dead Doctor Strange, but with a Doctor Strange and Wanda, who are the new, you know, massive villains of the MCU. That'd be cool. And I think that would be less, you know, when we were talking about, when we were watching WandaVision, of like, would it be a good thing to turn, like, the grieving lady, you know, kind of like the comics did, into the big bad villain who, you know, can't control herself? But, like, if the pair of them were to do it together, yeah, okay, I'm on board with that.
Or flip it, and it actually wanders on the side of the good, and Strange gets corrupted by the movie. I mean, I don't know.
No, both of them. That's what I want.
But I think part of the, you know, who knows, right? But perhaps, you know, Strange's kind of mentor role, or role as the grown up in Spider-Man's life or whatever, gets shifted a bit, you know, when the other two Spider-Men come in that last act. So I think particularly in the conclusion, they try and give, I mean, it's the lamest kind of send off line where, you know, oh, call me Steven. I think that's his final line to Spider-Man, which is, I mean, it's supposed to be in the callback, right, to them to them chatting, but it sort of doesn't, it's terrible, doesn't land at all.
And perhaps the first time when he says it and says, call me sir, you're like, what? Why have you been a dick?
And he just doesn't have, you know, let's say in some alternate reality where Benedict Cumberbatch, 10 years older, played Iron Man, and then Downey Jr., 10 years younger, is now playing Doctor. I just kind of feel like Cumberbatch has this prickliness where he's just not, I think maybe everybody, the performance, the movie thinks he's being more charming than he is when he's being a dick,
if Iron Man had said that, you'd have gone, oh, that's funny.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
Cumberbatch has got many talents, many, many talents. But, you know, I think being like, yes, he has. But being kind of charmingly, charismatically, like a bit of a cad, a bit cheeky is not, doesn't seem to be in.
That's all of the stuff that fell flat in the first Doctor Strange movie. The Beyonce stuff and the let's try and have a bit of fun at the funny duddy wizard's expense. Whereas I think at this stage, where I've seen enough of them as characters, and also, you know, of the respective actors as performers, I want that cheeky stuff from Wong. I don't want it from Doctor Strange. Wong's the one who I like set that kind of like little bit of banter from.
That said, worst bit of Avengers Endgame is them talking about the ice cream. I would happily delete that. That's the only thing in Endgame I would be like, nah, lose it.
I can't remember.
Just lose it.
What is that?
Hunker burning
ice creams.
Yeah.
Wait,
the ice creams that have been named after them? Is that the beginning?
Yeah,
right?
when Doctor Strange and Iron Man and Hulk are all in the Sanctum.
Oh, sorry, in Infinity War. Oh, right, okay.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Infinity War, yeah.
I was like, yeah. were they bantering at the funeral? This feels like
he's been blitzed.
Yeah, no, Infinity War.
Yeah, but yeah. Stephen Strange is a dick. He would have been bantering at the funeral, wouldn't he? He would have been.
Yeah, he would.
He's he would have been a
dickhead.
He would have been asking Harvey who the hell he was.
Been laughing in Peter's face, going, ah, your mentor's dead. You want me to be a new mentor? Well, I will, but I'll be a dick about it.
I'm going to be rude.
Reese, you said you had one more question. What was it?
Oh, the most important question of them all. This is for James only. Joe, I don't care about your opinion at all.
You might get it anyway.
Yes.
No, you're banned. James, you're in control of the record. Mute him. James J.W.Q. Hunt, what did you think of the costume at the end?
Willy Wonka.
Of the what? The costume.
The costume, the new costume.
Of course I loved it.
Yes.
I thought it was perfect. I don't know why he wasn't wearing it from the start.
They somehow I think we talked about on the Hawkeye episode how like three quarters of the Disney Plus shows have ended with like and the character gets the costume you know he'll have.
Yeah.
And yet they did that again with this one and yet it somehow landed. You're like, yeah, oh my god, they're right, this is his first handmade costume. Oh my god,
this
like
is the thing, right? Every Spider-Man movie that has tried to deviate from the classic look of the character has fucked it up. But and I include every previous MCU Spider-Man film on this. Spider-Man has one look. It's iconic. You don't change it.
But you've forgotten at that moment at the end of that reveal at the end, I had kind of forgotten that they had changed it.
I
had, as you say, for all the Holland movies.
I had.
And that this was some kind of, you know, some kind of origin story of lots of the elements of the grown-up Spider-Man that we know, that we recognize from the comics, from the other movies, etc. And I thought that was very elegantly done, you know, sort of contractual stuff aside, maybe they wanted to set it up to be X, Y, and Z. But other than that, when you realize at the end, oh, he's in an apartment, he's probably going to, you know, no, he doesn't have any friends, he's made his own costume, he's swinging in the snow in Manhattan. Because the other thing that, you know, was more remarked upon, I think, with the other two Hollands is like they sort of hadn't done a ton of like Spider-Man swinging around Manhattan.
They still haven't really.
Yeah.
Well, but it's
the most you get of it is in Infinity War.
That's true. Yeah.
Where he's in Greenwich Village.
It is. This is not a comment on the costume because I did kind of go, oh yeah, that looks like the actual Spider-Man costume. but it is funny how that is a returning bit that these movies somehow managed to pull off, which is all movies and TV shows, which is to go, for such a long time, here is our spin on the costume. Do you like it? Well, wait until you see the real one, which is the one that was debuted in the comics decades ago. And it's like, ah, now you've got it. And it seems to always work. We've just said it's happened like two or three times on the Disney Plus shows where they've gone like, and look, that's the costume that's more like the one that you would recognize in the comics. Even like the Falcon one, right, has some had a bit of comics precedent of this is what Sam Wilson in the Captain America suit would look like.
Yeah,
it's wild how often they return to that and how often it works.
I blame the X-Men movies for this because they went, oh, not costumes, practical jumpsuits. And ever since then, it's been like, well, we can't do a real superhero costume, but how about Captain America is wearing fatigues that look like a superhero uniform?
Oh, I love the first Captain America costume, though. That's great.
The first one is great, yeah.
Yeah, where they're going.
And the Avengers one is terrible. And they after that, they sort it out.
And because they've got the two versions in that movie as well. They've got the practical army duds and also the USO version. Oh, but what like a great movie. God, should we talk about that one for a bit? That's a good episode.
Like, if you're doing a Spider-Man costume that is just a jumpsuit with a design on it, there's no reason not to go straight to the iconic one. But, like, the reason it works in this moment here is because he's, like, weirdly, they ended this trilogy by giving him a sort of origin moment of, like, oh, his Aunt May died and, you know, he's out on his own. He's learned every lesson he needs to learn as Spider-Man and now he can do it properly. Here he is in his actual costume, not some magic nanobot costume that Tony Stark made him.
I guess
that's why it works.
I wonder whether they're just getting all these characters in their established costumes in these moments like they'll do them all the Avengers, all the guys, and then just to then do all this again with like all the Fantastic Four characters and all the X-Men. Introduce them as like with some version of the costume.
We'll see six Wolverine years. Films before he puts his Wolverine yes. costume on.
He puts the yellow and
he blue. Finally finds his jacket from X-Men.
Finally gets his claws. Yeah.
Can we talk
the movie?
I wonder if you want to talk about that. I don't think it ties into what we're talking about. The Aunt May moment and the great no,
let's,
power.
Let's go through the movie now, because we have been promising to do this for like an hour. Let's go through it semi-chronologically to kind of... we'll have talked about some of this stuff already. I guess the one thing that was surprising to me straight away was that this movie was picking off like straight off the back of the last one. Not that the MCU chronology matters much anymore. But, you know, is this before the Eternals aborted Celestial? We don't know.
Do we care?
No. But I thought it was interesting. It picks up straight away. We've got the Mysterio.
Yeah, but then there is like a four-month gap in the middle of the film, right? Because it starts in summer and it ends at Christmas.
Is there?
Yeah. There's like a sequence where he's... you know, under fire from the press, and then they're going back to school, and then it's applying to college.
That takes 4 months.
Yeah, and then at the end of the movie, it's Christmas. So, like this film takes place over the course of about 6 months.
I did not read that at all.
I think, as you say, okay. James. It's at the beginning. I think it's like pre all of them not getting into college, and it's post.
Yeah,
the sort of status quo of everyone knows him. He's in the new apartment. Yeah. I guess then 4 months passes. But yeah. Do you think that was only because it came out at winter time? Like, I wonder. I just sort of wonder about that. I'm not sure. Why is it set winter? You know, it doesn't need to be.
Is it the same? Is it the same Christmas in New York as the Hawkeye stuff is happening? Is it?
There is that line in Hawkeye.
Yeah, there is the Rogers musical.
And there's the line in Hawkeye where Kate says something like, Yelena says, I want to go and see the new Statue of Liberty.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, the Statue of Liberty.
We'll get to it.
It's like this is the most fantasy moment of this entire film. The idea that ever a nation could align enough to actually make that happen is absurd.
Yeah.
Especially given that this was presumably also in a world where that shield is currently held by the hugely controversial Sam Wilson. Yeah, wild. Anyway,
Captain America.
I like the idea that old Steve Rogers, like old Chris Evans, is just watches that as the news unfolds and just thinking like, you fucking dorks. You guys are such fucking dorks to do this. Anyway.
We pick up at the start of the movie right after Spider-Man swinging with Zendaya. I thought this was one of the better, funnier sequences of the movie with Zendaya, with Mary Jane just not MJ, sorry, not really enjoying the swinging at all. And when he did deposit her on the crane and then just walk off, I was like, hang on a minute. She doesn't have Spidey powers. This is, you can't just pop her there and then the film addressed it, which is good. They're all called in and interrogated by Damage Control. I'm not sure why Damage Control would be interrogating them other than they were in the first movie as well.
Yeah,
that must be a John Watts like, hey Feige, can I just have this one little slice of something, please, just for me, and just for my own purposes.
And when we were watching the trailer, we were zeroing in on that scene, going, he's been interrogated. Who's that person's arm next to him, whose face we can't see? Is that Matt Murdock? And then the film goes, no, it's not. Next scene, here's your boy right there.
Yeah.
Ah. I was very happy. I remained unspoiled on this as well, which, I don't know how I had done that whilst watching Hawkeye.
You have no idea how desperate I was to tell you, Joe.
Yeah.
I did. And you're like, do you think we see Daredevil again? I was like,
I liked that. Here's my controversial take. I liked that they sort of are embracing Charlie Cox's disappearing hairline. And they're like, you know what? Superheroes can be going bald. We don't care anymore.
I didn't notice that, but that is lovely.
I've noticed that since the third season of Daredevil. I'm like, oh, Charlie, dude, you do not have the hairline of a superhero man. Uh-oh, you got to maybe go to whoever Ed Norton went to pre The Incredible Hulk. Look at that guy.
Talking of the meta-narrative and being happy to see an actor getting that shot again. I was just thrilled for him. He's always struck me as a thoroughly lovely guy, and I thought his performance as Daredevil was really good. And I liked that he kind of turned up in this, and you know, is just exactly that character again. Just like felt like he just slipped back into it.
If there is any justice, he'll get his own movie or his own Netflix series or own Disney
Netflix
series.
Well, something. I got an issue. Netflix. There's three of those guys.
If there's any justice, they'll use him more. I was so surprised.
I'd love a movie.
Absolutely. I was so surprised that it happened because, like, I think I'm on record somewhere as going, like, they'll never do it because you'll have kids go in and be watching, like, can we watch Netflix Daredevil? What's he doing to that man's eye?
But, and next they'll be watching hardcore pornography. It's slippery slope.
But, you know, props to everyone who said it might happen. It happened. And I could not be happier.
I also thought it was, it was sort of just to tie back a tiny bit to another piece, but I'll tie them together. The fact that, again, we were all sort of speculating and thinking about how the J. Jonah Jameson would, and if Daredevil's in it, how that would all tie into the multiverse stuff. It must do. And then actually, no, it doesn't. It's, you know, the sort of J.K. Simmons stuff, they have no interest in ever, you know, in addressing in any way. It's just this character exists in this universe. He's played by this actor. It's a slightly different take on the character. I don't think we're supposed to think this is, you know, Sam Raimi, J. Jonah sucked through a portal. Just deal with this actor playing the character and that's great. And then the Charlie Cox stuff.
Yeah,
he's just in it, and you know they're not good. They're not interested in answering questions about what does that mean about the canon, blah blah blah. No, he's just in it. We'll figure it out. You know? And I liked that.
I kind of hope after seeing this and what they did with J. Jonah Jameson, who you know, other than he's had his memory wiped, I don't think there's a way that you can argue that that's the same character. I think he is, you know, this universe is Jameson.
Yeah.
Do we agree on that?
100%.
Yes, he's a Nexus being.
So I really hope that that's now what they're doing with Daredevil and Kingpin as well. And that we remove all of the baggage. We remove any kind of, you know, we can do Bullseye again with no worries. And I know that technically you can say, well, J. Jonah Jameson was in a different universe the first time around. Those two were kind of supposed to be in this one if you believed the canon that we were being sold at the time. I just think remove it all, give us a completely fresh take on those characters, but with those actors essentially, you know, giving the same performance. Can I ask,
do you think if we see Kingpin with the next, well, let's presume, when Kingpin and Daredevil interact in the future, will that be for the first time or will they have interacted in the past?
I think
they'll keep it ambiguous. Hmm. I think they may reference having previously met, but they're not going to be like, in the previous three seasons of story we told together, I think it would just be like, Fisk is the villain, Daredevil's the hero, and that's all the backstory you need.
I think it would be kind of sensible for them at one point to make explicit that stuff happened in a different multiverse.
Ooh, yeah, interesting.
I think it would be sensible. I think the easier route will just be to pretend no one has ever seen these before and see how it goes.
Which is generally what they do, which is to try and avoid.
Because TV audiences are so tiny compared to movie audiences, right?
Let's not include Kingpin, but Charlie Cox in No Way Home, he's dressed exactly the same as the show, exactly the same. So
yeah.
You know, if they wanted to code ever so slightly that this was a separate world to the Netflix stuff, I don't think they would have done that.
I don't think that's what they're doing now. I'm saying that's what I hope they do. rather than try and... I think, you know, the three options they have are, say, these are brand new versions of these characters, or to say, we're going to keep it ambiguous and never talk about it, or to say, these are the versions of those characters you've seen before. I think the most likely is ambiguous. I think the worst decision would be to explicitly say, these are the ones you've seen before, and I think the best would be to give them a clean slate.
We should probably move on from Daredevil.
Yeah.
Do we see Jessica Jones, Kristen Ritter?
No.
I actually think that, yeah, there's a chance that we see Jessica Jones and Luke Cage again.
Poor Iron Fist.
I think
Jessica Henwick.
Jessica Henwick.
Jessica Henwick is currently Iron Fist in the Netflix MCU. So
yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
Yeah.
I'd be absolutely fine with that. On Jameson, I loved how direct they were with he's basically Alex Jones, right?
Yeah.
It was to the let's take a pause to advertise some health supplements. I was like, he is InfoWars.
Yeah.
I love that one shot where you see the cut away from the angle of on him at the booth, and you see all the, you know, yellow post-its on the wall. That was great. That was almost in that one single shot at the beginning, gave you all you need to know, plus the vitamin supplements bit. It was great.
I think that's the more, I completely understand the history of Jameson and you know, why he is what he is. But I think now in 2021, that's the more, I think, I don't know if ethical is the right word, but that's a more responsible depiction of Jameson, is to have him as an internet kook rather than an entrenched like editor of a mainstream media source. Like, one feeds into this idea that the lamestream media are fake news telling you to get vaxxed, and the other one is, here's this fucking nut bar on the internet who, doesn't care about what he's saying. He just has an agenda that he wants to push. In that
yeah, although...
And that is, we don't like Spider-Man.
Does that distinguish him from lots of mainstream news outlets in the US? Because I'm not sure it does.
Well, yeah.
Certainly doesn't distinguish him from GB News over here.
No, but it probably distinguishes him more from, you know, the Bugle, the way it's set up, is like the New York Times in previous depictions.
Yeah, I mean, this version of the character is a bit more like the version from the computer games, actually, from the Spider-Man PS4 games.
Yeah, with his
in which Ruby he podcast, is the sort of yeah. Alex Jones podcaster. Yeah,
yeah.
I do think it's interesting over the course of this film how he goes from being a kook in a basement to having a full team around him with a green screen studio and stuff.
Yeah, they definitely. Another point is, I think they are delicate with the fact that. I wouldn't be surprised if the next movie or if the relationship between Peter and Jonah is a thread in the next, let's say, the next trilogy, and it's more, and there's a more interesting and softened dynamic between the two because Jameson is a little more softened. I think they were delicate enough to, you know, to allow that for the future, because, you know, you've got J.K. Simmons, who's a wonderful actor, and there's loads of great Jameson stories in the comics that you could sort of transition to going forward. I wouldn't be surprised if Peter is working for him whatever we see him at.
I would feel uncomfortable with that. As soon as you introduce a character as a parallel to Alex Jones, I would be uncomfortable with giving that character any kind of softening or redemption, personally.
I think that setup is hard to do as well, because it explicitly involves Peter actively lying in a way that is borderline unethical. I think that setup is something that they, classic though it is, they would probably avoid doing, because it's not a very sympathetic one to defraud your employers.
I guess maybe more sympathetic is defrauding InfoWars rather than... Yeah. Rather.
Purposefully undermining InfoWars, sure. That's a different angle that they could work with.
Anyway, so we've alienated any of our InfoWars fans. apologies for that, guys. things suck for Peter. He moves into Happy's apartment with Aunt May, and... This did make me laugh. The movie starts like the breaking point for Peter is the universal relatable dilemma of me and my friends had assumed we'd get into this really prestigious school and we haven't. It'd be like starting off the Joe Cunningham story with like,
Get into Oxford again.
Gonna need to go see a wizard. Didn't get into fucking Oxford. And me and my two friends. I'm going to break into the Dean of Oxford's car on a motorway to try and convince them that this is actually a good idea.
Just hold on a minute. I think they make it clear that he's annoyed. He's trying to do right by his friends. Actions have screwed their lives up.
Yeah,
and he says a few times, like, don't care about me. You know, these guys should be getting into.
Yeah, no, I am merely poking fun at the idea of this devastating moment is they didn't, all three of them had kind of assumed and then didn't get into MIT.
I thought they were going to end the film with, it's okay, we'll all go to Empire State University instead. But no, that's not good enough.
No. So Peter goes to the Sanctum and he sees Doctor Strange. And, you know, we've talked about that whole exchange. It's a bit weird. Who are the two randos who are sweeping up in there? Just some...
Is it Velma James, do you think?
Just some disciples.
No, but do you think it's the disciple from the... from the Mark Waid run, is that the run? Her name was Velma. Remember, she gets into.
Yeah,
I read that.
Jason Aaron, right?
Yeah, Jason Aaron. Yeah.
No, I don't think it is. But
okay.
So yeah, it's snowing in there, but that's only because a portal got left open, and that's it leads to the fun exchange about Wong is actually the Sorcerer Supreme now. I thought, didn't we find... I thought that at some point someone had finally called him the Sorcerer Supreme. Was that... Maybe it was in What If. I don't know. Maybe it was in What If.
I think it was in What If, and also, like, if it was, it would have been pre him disappearing for 5 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, they might call him that in Infinity War.
Yeah,
right? Because he is at that point.
Maybe.
Yeah, well, no, he isn't at that point, though. Because he gets blipped.
Yeah.
So yeah, Wong is the Sorcerer Supreme now, and now he goes off recruiting Shang-Chi's and things like that. So he's too busy to be closing portals.
He looks like he's just really shoveling snow around. Like he's busy recruiting Shang-Chi. He's just like
That's where he's off. Okay, fine. So he goes off to recruit Shang-Chi, and Doctor Strange is like, all right, I'll do a spell for you. I could do the spell that will help everyone in the world forget that you're Peter Parker. Insane and irresponsible, and yeah, the two options are Strange is a dick, an irresponsible dick, which James, you were saying is kind of, this is the kind of thing that Doctor Strange would do in the comics.
Yeah.
Well, there's a glint in his eye. There's almost there's like, oh, I'm so smart. I've sort of figured out I can do I can make a big solution to this problem. And it's such a, you know, he's thinking too big at that point. He hasn't actually thought about the details. The decision, you know, again, we talked about this before, but the kind of idea is this Doctor Strange idea. And, you know, that he would do that for a character like Spider-Man, given that dynamic. I just think that kind of, it's the performance is the disconnect, or that's the letdown. It's like, doesn't connect to me in any of that, you know?
I wonder if there's even like a line of dialogue missing, because I can almost reconcile the idea of, here is this guy who was kind of brought low in the first movie and kind of trained up, and you felt like he was becoming a more decent version of himself. And then he's like, look, I fucking outfought Dormammu. I found the one solution to defeating Thanos. And I know I wasn't around, but I, you know, it was my nug that got the guys there. I can do whatever the fuck I want. And I can buy that. I just don't feel like that's an arc that I've seen the character on, because I just feel like, as I say, in the Avengers movies, he was kind of like purely like Zen noble.
Isn't the more cynical view that...
Task at hand.
Isn't the more cynical view that actually that version of the character... is not one that is that Marvel kind of think that they can build stories around and movies around, that actually they need him to be a little bit more deflated and a bit cheekier. And then presuming he's not killed off in his film, that's, they just need him. That's where they need him to tell stories with him, because actually a more zen, mature Sorcerer Supreme, that's not a movie.
I'd love it if they made that choice.
I'd like finally, him to be the villain, and then he brings back understand. Bronco Henry. That's what I would like.
I've not seen it yet. I've seen the memes.
One for the Campion stands out there. Campion stands, I hear you. I've seen the memes.
I think I'd like to see him be just a complete villain. I think I'd love to see that turn go with him, and that we finally embrace the true hero of the first Doctor Strange movie, which is Chewie's Baron Mordo.
I thought you'd say Rachel McAdams is Dr. Susan?
Michael Stuhlbarg's character name redacted.
I think
Dr. John Smith.
I think the next Doctor Strange movie will give us clarity on this stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's going to be boring clarity. It's not going to be interesting.
Rhys, I think it's impossible that character is Velma or whatever her name is, because I think that's kind of the role that America Chavez is going to be serving in Multiverse Madness. But it's a guess. Okay, so they do the spell. It goes wrong. And,
oh, God, worse in the film.
Yeah, and Doctor Strange gets mad and he's like, right, piss off. Go on. And it's like...
I want to go back to spell for a second. At the point when Peter goes, oh, can my aunt remember me and my girlfriend? At that point, Strange, just stop the spell. Stop the spell, right? Reset.
No, he can't stop the spell. That's the point.
Why can't he stop the spell? Why?
Because...
He stops it eventually. He does stop
for
it.
For narrative reasons.
Right, okay.
But on the flip side, on the Spider-Man end, right, when Spider-Man's like, oh, well, I'd love it for Happy to remember me. Like, who cares what Happy? You've got the people you need. Genki, May, and Zendaya. Okay, that's who we need. That's the list. And now Strange can do the rest of the spell. Happy? No. They broke
off. I'm so confused by how the logistics of all the forgetting works as well, by the way. Like,
it'll be the same as in the regular Marvel Universe, which is that people will remember that they did things with Spider-Man. They just won't remember who Spider-Man is.
Yeah, it's wacky.
Yeah.
I was when I was sat there with... But, you know, in the scene at the gravestone, I was like, what are Happy's memories? Because, like, how does he think he met May in the first place?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, he'll think he met May
through
her being the aunt of some kid who was on the Stark program or whatever.
But who was Spider-Man?
No, you won't remember that kid was Spider-Man.
But they both say that they knew her through Spider-Man.
Yeah, maybe.
It's sweaty. It's real sweaty.
It's magic. It's magic.
here's another trippy question, right? At the end, there are people coming through the multiverse because they know that Spider-Man's Peter Parker. And the spell works. Does that also mean that, Kirsten Dunst forgets that Tobey Maguire is Spider-Man? has he erased that knowledge from the whole of the multiverse? These are questions I need answering.
That's our question. Yeah, that's I
Joe?
I think yes, he has erased all those people. He's ruined every Spider-Man's life.
Jesus, Stephen Strange is getting worse by the minute. This guy's a real
Okay, I'm gonna start moving through this plot a bit faster. Peter harasses the MIT administrator to try and get MJ and Ned's applications reread. But that's when Dr. Ock arrives. Thankfully, not all of this movie, like all of the trailer, is set on this freeway. we get a fight between Doc Ock and Peter. I think Alfred Molina's great in this. I love that. Because I think it's kind of the perfect approach for a character actor in this kind of movie, which is stroll into it and know that it is silly nonsense. Know that it is silly nonsense that you're lowering yourself to. Genuinely, I think that. But give it everything. And go, this silly movie needs a performance that I'm fully committed to, but it also needs me to know that it's a little bit silly, because that's where the fun of the performance comes from. You know, that's something that I don't think we're going to get from Jared Leto as Michael Morbius. it's similar to what Tom Hardy's doing. You know, I think Tom Hardy knows exactly the kind of movie he's in. But that's not stopped, you know, but
even if no one else does.
Yes. But he's, you know, he's
me and Joe do.
and I think Willem Dafoe, is doing that as well. The others, I mean, as we talked about, Thomas Hayden Church, and I actually think, yeah, Thomas Hayden Church is, you know, solid. And I like the idea of bringing back a villain who's not really a villain, who's already kind of redeemed. I thought they could have done more with that there, of here is a character who's just like, yeah, I'm not going to die. Just send me back, please. Like, I just want to, I'm the one here who doesn't die. This is, but also I'm a good guy. So I don't want these guys to die, but also can I just go home?
They'd have done more with that if Hayden Church was a bigger star, both, you know, now,
yes.
I guess.
Probably.
Like, he's not, you're selling the villains on Fox, Dafoe and Molina. Mm. The other two are also there.
I'm all right in saying I think they have redesigned the lizard, but
not enough.
But not enough, because fuck me.
I don't understand.
It looks like something that Super Mario Brothers shat out.
given that they just went, okay, Jamie Foxx looks like Jamie Foxx now. I don't understand why they didn't go, and the lizard looks like the comics lizard. Maybe they were worried it just wouldn't be believable as the same character if they did that, but they could have said, oh, the lizard has mutated further.
They get around it by, if you remember when they go into the apartment and then somebody says, oh, Connors wants to stay in the van. They get around it by just putting him in the van and never showing you him in the van for like half an hour. Like,
they get around it by trying to keep him out of the movie as much as possible.
Yeah.
By having him in darkness when there are scenes of him talking. Yeah.
Because, even in the Garfield corner of this movie, like, I don't think Andrew Garfield and Risa fans remember working together. we should talk about Jamie Foxx and Electro. So he's no longer blue. He's no longer listening into EDM. He's just Jamie Foxx now. I can kind of see them ringing up Jamie Foxx and saying, will you do this again? And he's going,
yeah. No, yeah, makeup, or filling, $10 million. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to do the bare minimum. I get a high credit. Fourth Bill, yeah. Man.
I will be.
He's like Fourth Bill.
I will be Jamie. Yeah. I will be Jamie Foxx in this movie, and. Again, that some of the lines around this character are sort of like, oh yeah, I'm kind of look at me in this universe, I'm cool. Why?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because he looks like Jamie Foxx.
Why? But not only that does he look cool, that he's had a complete character transplant where he's just he's just cool, sexy Jamie Foxx now rather than Dwayne Dibley.
Yeah, I mean that's the best approach they could have taken Dwayne with that character. Because he's so awful in Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Reese, this would not have happened with our previous co-host.
Reese, do you genuinely not know who Dwayne Dibley is?
Who's Dwayne Dibley?
Oh my god, okay.
Didn't he play Max Dillon in...
Go and watch Red Dwarf, yeah. And then come back.
Oh, Red Dwarf. Oh, okay.
Oh yes, my god.
I'm currently watching Cheers and Peaky Blinders.
It's going to be a while.
Red Dwarf. Third slot, Red Dwarf. I have to watch 180 episodes of Cheers first, and then straight into Red Dwarf.
Okay.
I'm straight into
good.
Red Dwarf.
Good.
You can hear Seb in my head.
I was going to say, we can...
Absolutely furious. Don't let him on this podcast anymore until he knows who Dwayne Dibley is. Yeah, you should watch Amazing Spider-Man 2 and the Dwayne Dibley episode of Red Dwarf back to back. The first one, particularly.
Should I watch Amazing Spider-Man 2 again? I'm good. Hard pass.
No, actually, don't do that. So Spider-Man and Octavius have the fight on the bridge, which Spider-Man wins because of his nanotechnology.
Bad scene.
I always
again.
Feel a bit weird about that.
Yeah. It's too easy, isn't it? It's too easy.
Yeah, it that's what it is. But I think some things in this movie have to be easy because
there's a lot to get
because through. There's so much to do. Yeah. So the nanotech does that, and then see what you think, guys. Later in the movie, when Otto gives the nanotechnology back to Peter, and it grafts onto his suit and creates that little gold bit. Oh, I hated that little gold bit. What did you think? I thought that was...
Well, that's the bit from the suit from before, right? Those are the arms from the.
It looked like it,
from the suit from before.
It looked like it,
right?
the gold bits looked like they'd been kind of like they were like an iron-on transfer. I thought.
Again,
but James,
I'm just trying to try and connect with James here and try and have a hot take on a suit.
Sure.
Anyway, so all
my take on that suit was they did it because they wanted another action figure to sell.
Fine. So the multiverse has kind of had cracks in it and has brought some people who know Peter Parker is Spider-Man to this universe. So I actually think that's a fairly neat way of doing it, of going some people who know Peter Parker is Spider-Man have snuck through the cracks. I would
except Electro. Electro didn't know that Peter Parker was Spider-Man.
Oh, did he not?
Right? He didn't.
Oh, okay.
That's of the five, that's because that's why when he takes his mask off and then he makes the comment about, I always thought you were black, he didn't know he hadn't seen him before.
Yeah.
I believe.
And also Venom.
Yes,
know.
And that's what I was going to ask. The Venom bit, I was like, unless there's something that franchise isn't telling us. Yeah, how would he know that Peter Parker is Spider-Man?
Is it maybe that Venom told him? I don't know. Like the Venom symbiote knew somewhere. I don't fucking know. I mean, that's
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, maybe the symbiote
maybe
knew.
Maybe the symbiote knew.
Symbiote got taken through.
Yeah,
I don't fucking know. I mean, it's a really that would win a no prize back in 1985. Yeah. That would definitely win a no prize. Stan, I believe that the only reason that Venom appears at the end of the post-credits scene is because the symbiote knew from the multiverse that they were the same character. Ah, oh, well done, kid. Excelsior, you win an Oprah.
So Peter gets given this, like, Doctor Strange zapping device that lets him zap them into, like...
Yeah, there's the toy.
Yeah, into little little cages in his dungeon. I made it sound sexier than...
Do you think he uses that like fabric? Grim.
And then the last one to get, because Spider-Man very quickly catches four of them. The one that takes longer, but he doesn't need to capture, is Norman Osborn, who very quickly returns to real comes to our world, but sheds his Green Goblin-ness for a second, smashes the helmet in a massive fuck you to that character design, which a lot of, which people always hated, but I never had a problem with. But I did like that that shot echoed the walking away from the mask in Spider-Man 2. So I was I was fine with that.
I'm Green Goblin, no more.
he goes and sees Aunt May, and Aunt May's like, look, this is just a poor, like, helpless man. You need to, like, you need to reach out with it to him.
Little does she know, the architect of her own undoing.
Yeah. That's the guy from the lighthouse. He's crazy. Don't let him in. He's insane.
Peter takes him back, and this is the thing that makes him kind of make the argument for we need to save them. And is this when they have the big fight in the mirror universe?
Bringing the goblin back, then at that point, it's only at that point that he realizes that they've actually all died just before. They've died at the hands of Spider-Man in their own universe just before they've been brought here, and so they can't be sent back.
Or in the vicinity.
And then Strange comes out? Sure.
Apart from Electro, who was flat out murdered by Spider-Man.
Yeah, it was exploded by Spider-Man and Gwen Stacy. Yeah.
And does Sandman die in Spider-Man 3?
No, he drifts away in the wind.
Does he? I thought that Sandman at the end has the moment where he gets to return to his daughter, doesn't he?
Does he actually return? My memory is that he's like, I'm off now. And then he just sort of flies away in the wind and never see him again.
Sad Hulk walking away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the irony is that the Sandman, like, I have to heal him to return to his universe. Or, the premise of I have to heal them so that they're good again and not evil and return to universe so they're not killed. It doesn't apply, and the only reason that that's happened to them is because they know I'm Peter Parker. It doesn't apply to Sandman. It doesn't apply to Electro because he doesn't know. Nobody cares about Life and Lizard, and you know. So I guess it's just two, right?
I do like the Lizard bit where Andrew Garfield's just like, oh, I've killed him before. It's fine. I know how to do that. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. So this is the part where they go into the mirrored event. So Doctor Strange brings out his magic box and he's like, right, I'm going to send them back to the universes because I got my magic box. And then Peter says no, and he steals the box, and Doctor Strange takes him into the mirror dimension. They have a fight in the mirror dimension, and Peter manages to trap him there because he knows science, which I'll be honest, I liked this. I
thought that was a really good moment.
In the MCU's kind of like science is magic, or magic is science, you know, they've always had that kind of interplay between the two of them going back to Thor. I kind of liked him going, geometry. Yeah, okay, I can figure this out. And I thought it was the moment in the movie where Doctor Strange's arrogance was his downfall, which was nice.
The mirror dimension still makes no sense at all. What is it? But you know, fine. The movie, it doesn't matter really. But I don't understand what it is.
it's in the name.
No, but what is it? Are all the people dimension in the other place? I don't. Are they living mirror lives? Like. Did you do opposite things opposite way? Is it like every day's opposite Friday? I don't understand.
The mirror dimension is a dimension which causes the surroundings to be reflected in different directions, similar to the function of a mirror, without affecting the real world. Due to its nature, it is used by sorcerers for training and controlling threats.
It's incredible because you can just reel it off. That's just from memory. That's really impressive. I'm impressed.
How do you feel about that?
Okay.
Do you feel better?
I feel almost. I feel embarrassed that I ever asked. Yeah. I feel ashamed, and I feel sad. I feel sweaty.
I'm glad. So Peter manages to trap Strange in the mirror dimension, but takes out the sling ring with him, which he just casually hands to Genki. Is like, you can play with this if you want. He takes the villains to Happy's apartment, where he tries to cure them, and he does manage to cure Dr. Octavius, and almost cures Electro, but Electro's always feeling a bit conflicted about it. Again, I kind of feel like of the villains to go, I actually want to really embrace my villainy. I'm not sure that Electro is the one that I would have gone with.
Yeah, especially because Electro was such a big Spider-Man fanboy in his original incarnation. Yeah, tragic, tragic bullied figure.
Yeah, I just always feel bad for that character. I was kind of just like him. I would have liked him to maybe have been like maybe the moral center of the villains. But
it's process of elimination. Yeah, Melina is the redeemed one. Goblin is the secret real villain, and so you just and then
the other two don't matter.
Thomas Hayden Church, you have for half a day, so they can't do anything. So therefore, we're with Electro.
the big showdown here is Peter's spidey sense.
This is
this
is very sweaty. I think this is the other very sweaty sequence of the movie. The idea that Tom Holland at 18, right, plus the Stark fabricator can cure five of these this whole franchise's greatest villains. You know, that is very sweaty. You do have to. There is a level of buy-in there, you know, and I know that he doesn't do it all now, but they end up basically doing that, and you do have to.
The Stark fabricator is.
You do have to jump.
The Stark fabricator is.
A wizard did it.
Yeah, right? Just randomly being in Happy's apartment is a thing. I guess the charitable viewing of that is, well, what he creates to fix the Green Goblin doesn't work. But he does, he does fix Doc Ock and his Electro device does work.
I'm reading into it now a bit too much, but it's a little bit like sort of techno futurist dystopia, because it's like, hey, remember Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield and his bad guys? Well, he couldn't do anything about those guys. You know what we have though? Technology, and that's great, and that solves all the problems. We'll just use a big computer machine box. I know it's Spider-Man. He invented shit, but it's also. It's like a bit weird.
Reese, I was, as I know you do as well, listening to Blank Check, and Griffin very briefly talked about this movie and referenced the fact that no one is accusing certain characters in this movie being a Mary Sue, the way that, you know, has blown up around other franchises in the past. I do think that is kind, you know, that is certainly with the Ganky and the Sling Ring stuff is definitely a thing. And I think you're right that here as well with the teenage Spider-Man is able to fix all of these villains that the other Spider-Men just had to let die is there as well. But again, I do think it does tie into the, you know, maybe the you know, the slight arrogance of this Spider-Man as well that leads to the death of Aunt May. That maybe you can again be charitable and say he thinks he can do it, but he can't. And that's
I have got to say, I've been keeping quiet about this because none of this bothered me in the slightest when I was watching the movie. I was just like, he's Spider-Man, he can do inventing, that's fine.
Yeah, this bit didn't bother me. The Ganky stuff did, but this bit in the moment didn't.
I'm kind of, I've established my credentials as to liking this film, so I'm kind of happy to sort of slightly nitpick and take frivolity with these sequences.
I think the Ganky Sling Ring stuff, I just sort of went, it's fun, I guess.
Now, the Aunt May death. Did anyone see this coming?
I've got thoughts. No.
No.
No, yeah. I didn't either. I
I read the Wikipedia plot summary, but other, before that, no.
So in the moment, I thought it was surprising. I thought it was effective. I thought it really made sense that for this Spider-Man, I guess the thing that I'd always assumed was something had happened with Uncle Ben in the past, right? Because he was Spider-Man when we already met him. I kind of just assumed he'd already got the great power responsibility stuff and the lessons that he'd learned along the way. But if you're going to be direct about it, and also, you know, those previous two Spider-Men are so explicit and you're bringing about that idea, you're bringing them back. I thought it was a great idea to do it as part of this movie. it didn't feel like a fridging to me. It felt like just an important moment in a Spider-Man story is losing someone who's really close to him. The thing that I thought was curious was, James, you alluded to this earlier, she's kind of the architect of her own demise. So it's not like in the previous Spider-Man movies where the arrogance or kind of selfishness of Peter Parker or mean-spiritedness of Peter Parker. So basically, the version of Peter Parker who's beating down on Green Goblin at the end of the movie, that's what would normally lead to the death of an Uncle Ben, right? When he starts acting like that. I thought it was interesting that it was May's trusting people that led her to be killed. But also, even in that moment where she has been, stabbed by the glider and dying, she's still making the argument to Peter that he needs to...
You have to be nice to people. Have to save people, yeah.
With great power, there must also come
great responsibility. Yeah.
I've got many thoughts.
Go on. Let's get all the thoughts.
Okay, so one, I don't know. I presume James did know this. I never knew that that was the full quote.
I did know that was the full quote.
I knew that that was the full quote, Reese.
And actually, when you think about the full quote versus the smaller one. Actually, the smaller one means nothing, really. It's too passive. It's not Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. With great power comes great responsibility. Well, sure, but then maybe the villains or baddies or heroes, bad heroes don't accept that responsibility. The longer version is the Spider-Man ethos because it's that active.
I love that in this moment, old comic book rube Joe Cunningham was watching this going, oh, that's great. She said the full quote.
To be honest with you, when the movie was, because I think this quote wasn't in the Wikipedia plot summary, so this quote was a surprise to me.
It is now. I'm looking at it, it is now.
when the moment came, Reese went back in and added it after
the movie. He was like, I didn't get spoiled.
furiously typing. That they were doing a different spin on. They were like, "Oh, they've rewritten it a bit because we've seen it before, but actually it's the original." Anyway, sorry, that's one point. The other point I want to make is that if you unpack the idea a bit, I think it's not so much she's speaking about herself as well. Like she's sort of having this position of power, running this charity. If you drill down a bit, I imagine if you run a charity, you are faced with many people that might have issues or that might be a drain on you or have come to you under false pretenses. But actually, you have the power in that dynamic, and with that power, it's your responsibility to try and help those people, kind of no matter the consequences. I kind of like for me, it connected with what she was trying to do to help Green Goblin, what she was trying to teach Peter to help with the other characters. That the consequence of her death. The bad consequences, that's not the point. The point is that we have power. You have great power. And always you must be responsible with that power and try and help. I like that. It fit with me.
Was Feast established prior to this film with Aunt May? Because I couldn't remember it, but I when I saw her working at Feast, I was like, I know that from other... Mostly I'm like, I remember that in the games. I had to watch some boring cutscenes there.
Like the idea comes from the comics, it was in the games, and I believe in the previous movie when she's at the fundraiser, that's for Feast, right?
Right, okay.
Yeah. Like it was a minor part of the character, but it was in there, yeah.
So how do you feel about that inversion then of, she doesn't die because of... That basically Peter has his moment that would normally lead to the death of a loved one.
I mean, ultimately get Peter's decisions factor into her death in a way. Like, certainly, her decisions do as well, and that's what helps it not be a fridging, because, this is part of her story.
Yeah.
But I think the important thing about the Uncle Ben death is that Peter blames himself, and I think in this movie he can still come out of it saying... if I'd just listened to the others, maybe, you know, we'd have sent Green Goblin home earlier and she wouldn't have died. So it's on me in some way. But, you know, he's also got the salve of, well, it's what she would have wanted. So, it, you know, it's softened a bit, but I don't think it's softened in a way that ruins the moment. What interests me, and that I'll be looking forward to the cartoon they're doing, did this Spider-Man have an Uncle Ben at all?
No, so
we don't know.
So he did, if, like, Easter eggs in this franchise, because there was the suitcase in the last movie that had his initials on it. And, I felt like it had been implied that there was... Again, I think this is kind of like the clever thing that Feige does, which is to go, I'm not gonna confirm anything until I need to, because we can just say, well, there wasn't. Or
neither confirm nor deny the existence of Uncle Ben.
Maybe there was an Uncle Ben and he died in a fire. You know, there's or maybe there was
brutal.
Maybe there was an Uncle Ben and he moved to Yemen. You know, that's it. That's the, but it doesn't, because at the end, you know, when I would have loved in that scene if Peter had been like, you don't understand what I'm going through. And the other's like, no, we do. Like, my Uncle Ben died. And then the other Peter's like, my Uncle Ben died. And this Peter's like, yeah, my fucking Uncle Ben died. And now my Aunt May's died. You don't know what I'm going through. This shit has happened to me twice. I've already been through this character development. Why am I doing it again?
It also would have been funny if it was like, my Uncle Ben died. Yeah, my Uncle Ben died too. Yeah, my Uncle Ben moved to Yemen. Like, that would have also been quite funny. Yeah, Ben, I remember when Parker moved to Yemen with Total Oil.
I tell you now, if they'd known they were doing a fourth movie, like Spider-Man turns up at the grave to mourn and there's Uncle Ben standing there, that would have been a moment. That would have been your cliffhanger.
Played by...
Tom Hanks.
God, I can't think of anyone else but Tom Hanks.
John C. Reilly. You could see it.
Let's bring back because we've got form now in the MCU. Actors can play multiple roles. Let's bring back the great love story we saw in The Wrestler, Mickey Rourke.
Oh, God. He's played by Whiplash.
Mickey Rourke, Uncle Ben. God.
I've got a prediction. Here's a hot prediction. In the next Spider-Man movie, we meet Uncle Ben. And actually, he's still alive in the MCU. And he's one of Peter Parker's supporting cast. Boom.
If Mickey Rourke was Uncle Ben, you would want Spider-Man to kill him himself. Just push him off a bridge and pretend you didn't see him.
Where's my body? Ben, why is he?
If Mickey Rourke was Uncle Ben, the answer to where he'd gone would be drinking and boxing.
Yes. Oh, God.
Okay, Ned then uses the sling ring and creates the portals, and it's dumb and I hated it.
This bit sweaty, but he this creates bit the portals. Fucking sweaty. Because this is the bit where he goes, show me Peter Parker, right? And then we get... I think a key missing scene in this is between the two Spider-Men, there's just a random guy whose name is that, right? Because if the whole thing is you're shown a Peter Parker that's on this planet... Right, that's why you get the other two guys. Well, you should get like just some fucking guy.
Maybe Jake
Johnson plays. Yeah.
I didn't mind this. I'll be honest. I didn't mind the. I didn't have a problem with the show me Peter Parker and it's the other Spider-Man, because in that moment you're just like, oh, here they are.
Yeah, you are. You're like, holy shit! It's the worst of the three, and he's back. It's a good choice. A good choice to start with Andrew Garfield. It's the only way you're going to be excited about seeing Andrew Garfield is if you see him first.
I think he's really like sweet and lovely in the scene.
He's so good, like just immediately affable and charismatic, and the things he wasn't in the movies.
And I think that what played really well for me in this sequence was, here is a guy who's been zapped into this universe from a parallel one, from a multiverse, and he is kind of like trying to reassure them, and that like he's like, even it, like, I'm in a world I don't know, but look, I just need to check that you guys are not freaking out about this. Like, okay, I'll jump onto the ceiling for you. Here you go. And then, yeah, cleaning up the cobwebs in the corner, I thought was nice. And just how softly you spoke and he was. And I thought the little bit of stubble was a nice touch as well. His hair is so big still and luscious. And I think this movie really benefited from the, you know, from Andrew Garfield's career post
Stop out.
Amazing yeah. Spider-Man mm. and also the way that he's talked about being hurt by that franchise. Yeah. And it really does feel cathartic. And I would also say, you know, that for all of the talk about that we had in the Hawkeye episode about Oscar chances for this movie, which I've got to say after seeing it, I do think are fucking absurd, and that there is like there should be no universe in which this is nominated for Best Picture.
100%.
I think the way
plenty of technical Oscars.
The way to reward this move the box office of this movie is to go. Are any of these actors in contention for any of the major awards? Oh, hello, Andrew Garfield in Tick, Tick, Boom, one of the front runners for Best Actor. Maybe this is the nice little bit of nod of recognition towards Spider-Man No Way
Home. Hello, Zendaya in Doom. Hello, Tom Holland in Cherry. These are the give the awards out. You know, give these guys the awards.
Cherry was last year, right? It was last year, wasn't it?
Give him the award this year. That's how good it is. Give it again.
I think Andrew Garfield's great in Tick, Tick, Boom, by the way. I think that would be... I haven't seen most of the...
One of my favourite movies of the whole year, yeah.
I mean, the movies, you know, got all of the pros and cons that any Lin-Manuel Miranda project has. But I think he's amazing in it. So Andrew Garfield walks back in. Reese, you haven't said, like, were you as kind of like, oh, this is nice, as James and I were?
Yeah, I mean, this is the start, all of the stuff with the three Spider-Men is, it's a magic trick, and it's almost bulletproof for me. And I think the movie is, I think the reason that you have such high, cinema score and such hype, such positivity from audiences is that basically from this point onwards until the end, there's just this extreme lift in the film because you see the three interact together. And it's not just the three of them on screen together, but it's, you know, I think the writing, I think the writing is, it's just enough. It's sort of cheeky enough. It's emotional enough. It's specific enough. The three characters are different enough. All the stuff that maybe Joe, you don't agree with, but it's, I think it's perfect. I think it shouldn't work. It shouldn't work. That's why it feels like a magic trick.
Yeah, this for me is like it pays off the gimmick so well. Like, it justifies 100%. It on every level just by, like I say, it makes those previous Spider-Man films, even the bad ones, feel like they're in service of a greater story.
So I
and like it. Kind of it just
I'm not
works.
Sure I agree with that, actually.
for me, it absolutely does. It goes like, hey, we've been telling these Spider-Man stories for 20 years, but here's the essence of the character. Like, he's a guy who wants to help people and he's doing the best he can under bad circumstances. Shouldn't we all be more like that? Like, that's how it works for me.
I feel like from this point onwards, the film is a series of nice moments rather than something cohesively successful.
I find that hard to agree with.
I know you do. I also feel like the, as much as I like seeing these characters again, I think they do a lot of MCU-ifying of the way that they are talked to and kind of undercut in a way that the MCU likes to, you know, kind of likes to constantly be undercutting its heroes. And we should talk about Tobey Maguire. I think that's certainly some of the stuff that I felt works less with Tobey. Like, any of the kind of like little where they're kind of like ribbing at each other about their setups, I was like, I kind of feel like that version of this character, the Maguire version of the character, is he's so earnest that I don't think he really meshes well with the MCU vibe. And again, that's why I kind of felt like I enjoy the meta narrative of seeing Tobey Maguire here, but I'm not sure I am really enjoying seeing this Peter Parker there, because I'm not sure that it does feel like that Peter Parker, and if it does, I would like to see him treated with a bit more reverence.
No, for me, like, the meta narrative was all that mattered. It doesn't bother me that any of that doesn't line up. And I think it lines up more than you're giving it credit for. But I think it only needs to line up on the meta level, because that's what this film is about.
I think, yeah, Joe. I mean, Joe, the stuff you're saying just wasn't in my head either in the watching of it or post. It was very much pure enjoyment. However, I mean, you know, perhaps I'll go back to my very early comments, which is this movie is a lot of sugar. It's very sugary. These sequences are sugar, i.e. there probably isn't that much substance to them. Maybe I disagree with James on that. They're not substantial. They're not particularly, they're not, you know, invigilating any ideas or interested in much more.
See, I disagree with that as
these
well.
These toys playing with each other, but I got so much out of that, and I got enough out of that. I think maybe that's where the three of us are different.
On that point specifically, I think this Spider-Man movie gets the character in a way that probably not since Spider-Man 2, maybe never, has really been sort of handled on screen, which is that it makes a point out of, like, Spider-Man's thing is that he will try and save everyone regardless of how badly it affects his own life, and constantly throughout the film that's what he's doing. Like, nothing he does in this movie is selfish, and it articulates the core of Spider-Man as a character that just no previous cinematic outing has really nailed for me. Like, that's why I think this is a Spider-Man nerds film, is because it really homes in on that idea and is constantly hitting it throughout the movie. And it does so in a way that brings in every previous cinematic incarnation of the character and says, this is how it should be done. You know, we've tried it and tried it and tried it, and we've got all of these guys to the same point by the end of this movie.
We tried it and tried it and tried it. We got it right the first time. We did it a few times more.
Maybe that's, James, I think maybe your last, I've kind of agreed with you right up to the last bit. I do think that, you know, I do think that the bit in this movie where Tom Holland gets to the point where he goes, no, these characters shouldn't die, Spider-Man doesn't kill, reminded me of the, you know, the Dan Slott, what's it?
Yeah, No One Dies. No One Dies. Yeah.
That kind of that thread of storytelling, which is so Spider-Man-y, like, I completely agree with all that. I'm just not sure that that adding the other two Spider-Men post the Aunt May death up until the conclusion really through anything they do, you know, and character is action, through anything they do with each other or individually, kind of makes that point. I just don't connect with that. But I think Tom Holland could
broadly have told this movie from the Aunt May death forward without the other two Spider-Men.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think a major component of this movie is giving those other characters, like, a chance to undo, you know, the deaths in their universes and the fact that I don't think
Maguire gets that moment. I really don't.
He does, because he saves Tom Holland from bashing Willem Dafoe's skull in it.
What does that redeem, or what does that add to his character?
It means
that we hadn't got by the end of Spider-Man 3.
Well, it means that the Maguire Spider-Man was able to save Norman Osborn from dying in a way that he wasn't in the first Spider-Man movie.
Oh, actually, Joe, I hadn't thought about that.
No, but that's
I know Joe said it, but that's
That's a plot point. That's not an emotional arc moment, and it's not something that really plays to that.
It's for me, like, when in Spider-Man 1, when Willem Dafoe dies, he's
reaching to grab
in,
it
in Tobey Maguire's arms, saying, you know, keep my secret. Sorry, I did this. Don't tell Harry. And instead, Maguire gets to save him and be like, you know,
Maguire doesn't get to save him though. Tom Holland, that moment is doing another thing, and it's doing something for the
Tom
Holland
character.
It's doing
both.
I don't think it is. We've got a.
why make it Maguire if it's not doing both?
We've got a stabbed Tobey Maguire laying on the ground, gurning in that moment. I thought I didn't understand.
No. Maguire stops him from killing Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe stabs him afterwards.
Just to, right? just to compromise between the two of you, you're both right. I think that, James, you're right. The text of the movie is that, and if you come in loaded with that knowledge of the end of the first film, you get that. But to Joe's point, the movie doesn't really sell that in the way that it sells the Garfield yeah. moment. I think that moment.
That's fair.
And I feel like that the Gwen Stacy death is something that Peter's actions in The Amazing Spider-Man 2 lead to and that he feels responsibility for. It's not Peter's fault and it's not Peter's responsibility. It's not his actions that lead... that leads Norman Osborn to die in the first Spider-Man.
No, I mean, they sort of go out of their way to make it not Peter's fault in the first
because
movie.
Which,
all he does is jump out of the way and let him stab himself.
Yeah. And it didn't. And also, we are meeting these two characters, and the way that they're introduced is basically, here is one Spider-Man who has stopped pulling his punches and has kind of lost track of who the Spider-Man he wanted to be, and another one who's like, I've kind of got it figured out, you know. He's not a character that requires a moment of emotional catharsis.
If they don't want that subtext of Maguire stopping Holland from beating Willem Dafoe's skull in like that, it would have made more sense for it to be Andrew Garfield, because he would have been like, no, actually, anger isn't the way. I've been there, and you need to climb out of that hole. But
yeah, I agree.
Went, no.
I think this film would have this film would have been more emotionally coherent with one additional Spider-Man rather than two.
Yeah, but I think
if it was Amazing Spider-Man 3 as opposed to Spider-Man MCU 3.
Yeah, right? I think the intertext of all those movies can't be ignored. And for me, there were just so many moments that called back to everything, like from Willem Dafoe's.
Absolutely.
Yeah, from like. I was sort of in awe of how they managed to string everything together, really.
This is what I said at the start.
Magic trick.
I was really impressed by how competent it was plot-wise. And I think you're right. It does make loads of callbacks, and it doesn't go to pains to try and weave that stuff together. I'm not saying that there is no logic in that final moment where it is Tobey Maguire stopping him, beating him. But also, that's not a moment where I think it should be, you know, someone physically having to step in. Like, the work should have been done previously. Like, they should have been like Uncle Ben mentors to him that makes him realize.
Yeah, like the fact
that at that point in the movie, after having the discussions with the other Peters, that he is wailing on Norman Osborn. I was like,
yeah,
this is here because it's a climax moment rather than something that rings emotionally true.
That
for this
that
character.
For me, like the part of that scene that doesn't work is that Tom Holland's character is willing to go that far in the moment, because it just, I haven't felt like they sold the idea of him being unhinged or, you know, rageful in that way.
No. It's
broadly speaking, that's a nitpick. Like for me, I genuinely consider this on a par with Endgame in terms of how well it strings everything together rewards you for caring about the details.
That is part of what I was referring to at the start of the podcast, James, though, where I was saying that I think Tom Holland's kind of bad in this, because I don't buy the rage in that character. I also, if anyone's not listening to it and they're a fan of the TV show, I've been listening to the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia podcast, which I'm thoroughly enjoying, where they're ostensibly recapping episodes, but not really. They're just kind of making jokes at each other at the expense for half an hour a week. So they're talking about a scene where Charlie has managed to squeeze out a tear, and he's very proud of having managed to squeeze out this tear. And they're like, and you didn't have to use that thing where they come and blow menthol into your eyes. And they're like, well, we should explain that to the audience, that, you know, a lot of times when you see actors crying on screen, you know, people will always give actors loads of credit for crying on screen, but a lot of the time they've just hadn't got, it's like this air that's got menthol kind of run through it that they blow into your eyes, and it just makes your eyes kind of a little bit wet and puffy, and, you know, the tears flow really easily after that. And I'd listen to that literally like in the car on the way to go see Spider-Man No Way Home. And I was like, fucking hell, they've given Tom Holland a lot of menthol. And I just didn't believe, Like, he looks sad. He's a proper puppy dog of an actor. He looks sad, but I just didn't believe the depth of emotion from him. I didn't believe the rage as a reaction. And like I said already, I don't really believe the relationship. And this, you know, Tom Holland's an actor that when he was cast, I was like, oh, I remember that kid from The Impossible. I really like him. I like, I like his vibe. I am glad that he's going to be Spider-Man. I thought he was pretty good in the first movie. And I just couldn't buy it. And so that moment at the end of the movie, I just don't buy it as a moment for Tobey Maguire because of all of the stuff that's going on around it. And because I think the primary function of that is to give Tom Holland his power responsibility moment rather than, I think if they'd have leaned into it more, you know, that Maguire was the Uncle Ben of this movie, that would have been great, but that's not what they were doing.
I mean, for a second I was like, they're not going to bring back Maguire just to kill him off, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't.
Do we understand why that happened? Do you think there was a version of this movie or a moment where they were killing him off?
No, I think it was purely practical, like, okay, he's stopped Spider-Man from killing Green Goblin, but now we need Tom Holland to take the lead on the finale.
Let's get
Maguire off the board.
I bet there was a test screening where he died. I bet there was.
I'll be interested to hear.
Because I was sat there going, they best not have just fucking killed Tobey Maguire. And then it turned out that they hadn't. And I was like, why the fuck did they do that? Why did he get stabbed? Because I'm just like, I can't buy into
anything. He got stabbed to get him out of the way. That's as pure as that.
But, right, I care about that Spider-Man exponentially more than the other two, right?
Yeah, fair.
And so I am watching that entire scene going, shut up. What's happening with my guy down there with the stabbies in the back? Because the last person I saw got stabbed by Green Goblin.
a glider, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of rattled around for a while before she bagged it. So, I genuinely, that was my main concern in that scene. I was like, so is he dying? What's going on? He's okay. We sure he's okay? Okay, good, he's okay.
Yeah, but actually, like, I'm with your conspiracy theory. I think, yeah, you've convinced me. There's a cut where he dies, isn't there? Yes, I agree.
I should say, just to go back to the moment where they do introduce Maguire, I thought there was an interesting thing. I don't know if this is the same for you. I've seen Tobey Maguire on screen so rarely since The Great Spider-Man Gatsby. 3? No, the Great. I think The Great Gatsby is the last time that I can think that I saw him in, like, you know, a prominent role. And I don't know why he, you know, has been, whether it was, because, you know, even around Spider-Man, you know, he was in, I remember, you know, he was getting an Oscar push around Brothers, and, you know, he was a leading man in Hollywood, and, you know, pre-Spider-Man as well, and, you know, had quite a career. And, yeah, just hasn't done a huge amount. I'm just looking at his IMDb. He did The Spoils of Babylon and Pawn Sacrifice in 2014. And he's a voice in The Boss Baby in 2017. The only other thing that has kept him at the forefront of my mind is the fact that he's being played by Michael Cera in Molly's Game. Without them explicitly saying it. But, you know, but that's Tobey Maguire. And when he did walk back on screen, I think I thought it was interesting that they introduced him not in the suit. And that it was just, here is this guy. And it was more for me, it was like, who is Tobey Maguire now? What is his vibe now? Is he going to be able to recapture that Peter Parker essence? Because, you know, for all reports, he's a bit of a douchebag in real life, right? He's one of the pussy. He's one of DiCaprio's pussy posse, and he's this dick from Molly's Game, and, you know, he's the guy screaming at reporters and on TMZ and stuff. But he walked on and he was just a guy. And I just thought, like, from the way he was carrying himself and that kind of just, like, slight smile and kind of, like, oh, nothing important. I was just like, oh, yeah, okay. I thought of the, you know, like I said, I think Garfield is giving his his new version of what he wanted Peter Parker to be. But I thought Maguire was the kind of most effortless, just like, yeah, here I am. And also the older Peter Parker, who's just, I've kind of got things figured out at this point. He's the, I guess he's the Chris Pine Spider-Man of this movie.
Yeah, he of the two, he probably had the harder, the slightly harder tone to land on, because, you know, because Spider-Man is a kind of quite a youthful, cheeky character. That's just, that is the character. And actually in the comics have always, you know, have James, you will agree with this, like, have over the 60 years since Spider-Man first got published, like, you know, they run into trouble because they kind of go, oh, well, then, you know, in the kind of comics timeline of this character, he's aged 20 years and he's in his,
yeah,
he's an elder state. So actually he needs to be this youthful sort of cheeky character. So we have to do some kind of reset, or we'll send him into a mirror universe, or we'll fucking have Mephisto, you know, delete time or some bullshit. So Garfield can very much play
Peter Parker in his 20s, right? Basically, yeah.
And Holland's still basically playing Spider-Man as 18, even though he's 25.
Yeah.
Maguire has the tricky thing of, like, I'm actually, was, you know, 40 plus.
How old was Garfield when he was playing Spider-Man the first time around, though? Like, when he's literally, 20s, like, yeah. kicking around with his skateboard in high school. Yeah, exactly. How do you do, fellow kidsing?
So in this, though, I think Maguire's, I think Garfield's coded as, I don't know, mid 20s,
yeah,
with Holland coded as late teens, and therefore Maguire's coded as an adult, and so he has the sort of trickiest tone to land. Versus, you know, particularly, you know, what's he going to do versus his old appearances 20 years ago? And I think he lands it. I think it's, you know, for a guy who's not been on screen in 10 years, has not been on, you know, on screen, notably not being a movie star for 15, he lands it. He's charming, he's compelling, he holds the camera. It's sort of, yeah, you're reminded why that original Spider-Man trilogy works, and it is because Tobey Maguire, and he brings those same talents to this performance.
Did we all enjoy the back joke?
The back cracking joke, yeah.
Yeah, nice little in joke there.
There are lots of in jokes like that. I enjoyed I mean, generally, the thing I enjoyed most about Maguire coming back is that he got a happy ending after that sort of truncated downer of Spider-Man 3. Like, we find out, you know, he's still with MJ, they're still making it work, he's still Spider-Man, it's not perfect, but he's making a go of it. And, you know, he's got organic webs and the others don't.
I liked that. See, that's all the stuff that I mean, that, like, in the moment I'm like, this is fun, this is nice, I like it, and after the film I'm like, yeah, in a pure empty calories way, right? That's just, like, it's just you know, I guess what runs through my head is, you only like those moments because you like Spider-Man already. And the way that you kind of look at people confused when they're losing their shit for The Force Awakens, you know, that's what this is.
Mm.
It's playing the hits. It's giving me the stuff I want. And I kind of felt without much, flair, maybe, I don't know, like, certainly I like I said, I need to come back to this. I thought the filmmaking was so muddy.
Yeah.
I thought the CGI looked so ropey in this movie. Like, it was one of the flattest looking blockbusters I've seen, you know, within the MCU as well. I just visually really, really didn't get on with this movie. I think that's something that I understand, James, that you can go, like, individually, that doesn't matter as much to me. That's not what I'm here for. But it does matter to me. And, you know, I think when, you know, a movie like The Eternals gets battered, but does just in every frame ooze more sophistication than this movie. Like this,
God, I just could not disagree more with everything you said.
I just think it looks,
as far as I'm concerned,
it all looks like it's been made in a computer.
And Eternals, like, for me, looks more computer generated than a movie.
I just don't
a movie that was filmed on location, like, in great chunks of it.
Every time I saw the Spider-Men stood together, I was like, are you in the same room? If you are, I don't think it's this room. Nothing about it felt real. And I thought, yeah, particularly the final action sequence, I thought was ugly as hell.
I've seen that take. I think Robbie Collin, that is his full take. But it's weird. I read that before watching it. I just didn't feel that when watching it. And I think maybe, like me and James are, there's some disconnect, or there's something different that's happening to me and James in this film that doesn't happen to you, Joe, where we're just, you know, I've got reservations, I'm sure, you know, maybe more than James, but there's just something about, we're getting swept up in something that's making us not focus on that stuff.
Because
people are focusing on that stuff, but for me, watching it twice now, I just don't see it. I don't see these guys who are on the green screens thing. I don't see it.
I think if you're noticing the craft, it means the film hasn't worked. And I think, you know, at times it hasn't worked on Joe, and that's why he's sitting there going, this doesn't feel real to me, whereas you and I, you know, fully immersed in the narrative, don't care that it looks a bit green screen.
I've nitpicked for an hour 45.
What I mean. Like, we can, you know, we can always go back and nitpick, but at the time when we're watching it, we're like, it doesn't. The craft doesn't matter to us because the story works.
I was just my brain melted. I hadn't been to the cinema for, you know, probably close to 2 months, and then went back and saw Spider-Man and Matrix Resurrections on back-to-back nights. And I was like, how is, of these two films, how is the Matrix the one that is taking the shots for having crummy action? Because but the answer is expectations, right? I don't think people go to the MCU movies expecting great action. They go to a Matrix movie expecting it. I don't go to an MCU movie expecting great action, but I expect it to look better than this. I kind of felt like the entirety of this looked like the Underground Railroad section of Black Panther.
I can't agree with that. Wishes it looked like the Underground Railroad in the show, which it does not at all.
Yeah. Anyway, we disagree on that. Any of the other kind of moments in the final act that works for you? Because each villain kind of gets either, you know, like a saving moment, or I guess Doc Ock gets the moment where he turns up and intentionally pretends to be a villain for a minute so he can have his own hero moment.
Which is what you want to see, right? You want to see Spider-Man's friends helping him out. It's like the only good bit of Spider-Man 3.
I thought Melina got a bit beefed by this ending, you know, because I think that, you know, going from the marketing going in, you're like, oh, he's gonna have all the fun,
and it's Defoe
returning guys. No, it's not. No, I know. I don't think it's Defoe. I think it's Defoe. Yeah, sorry.
Thinking of a scientist
Electro,
himself.
Defoe Electro. But you're right. Exactly. I think the marketing, maybe that's intentional. It's hiding Defoe's stuff, but Defoe gets the proper ending stuff, and I kind of feel like Melina. Yeah, I just wanted something else from at the end there, something a bit more from him.
I think they gave us so much more of Melina and Defoe and Maguire and Garfield than I was expecting. I was imagining we would get cameos from these characters, not arcs.
Melina, I think by the time I got to see the film, what I was expecting was a Hannibal Lecter, like
stuck in one cell. Yeah,
and he is kind of like an uneasy ally, or flat out that he is, you know, he's fixed and he's a good guy, and then we get to spend the rest of the film. Whereas what happens is, once the Spider-Man come back, we just need to sweep him off to the side now because that's a problem that's been fixed. And again, I do have sympathy because a movie this big trying to fit in the things that it's trying to fit in, this is going to happen and some of it's going to feel sweaty. But when it all starts to add up over a movie, I think that's what You know, that's what started to make me feel a bit frustrated with it, especially thinking back, like, is that really the best they could have done with Molina? Shove his arc into half an hour in the middle and then forget about him? It's the best Spider-Man villain we've ever seen on screen, and that's it.
I think I'm with Joe on this, James, I'm afraid.
Anyway, he comes back and he's the one who stops Electro. Sandman and Lizard are fairly easily disposed of, and then we've talked the Green Goblin bit to death. I guess what we haven't talked about, again, I it was never a problem for me, but were you happy with the costume stuff?
Oh yeah, really cool. Really cool that they found a way, in my opinion, they found a way to somehow square that circle or square the, hey, we're going to bring Willem Dafoe Green Goblin back from that movie, and yet somehow get him to a more traditional Green Goblin in the comics costume. I love that. I thought it was
kind of nonsense.
It was a bit like the sequence in all the Hulk movies where like he gets a stretchy pair of purple tracksuit to wear, and then he hulks out in them. Like it was a bit that, you know. Like, oh, he just happens to be, or he'll just grab this purple hoodie from a clothesline and smash his mask. Like, but you know. The Goblin, it's a cool costume in the comics. It looks cool in the comics, his costume. And they didn't do it in that first movie. They did a very different version, which has its pros and cons. But I liked I thought it kind of had a mild audaciousness to it to try and of all the things this movie is doing, to also try and, hey, let's do a true to the comics Green Goblin outfit. I liked it.
I think so. I've talked about this before on the podcast, but I think so much of my relationship with Spider-Man is coloured by, I was introduced to all of these things by the Tobey Maguire movie. So, like for me, it's like, I don't know, that's what Green Goblin looks like. he's got those big yellow eyes and they're big plastic heads. And that is fine.
But I think that's the Feige. I think that is. That's one of the understated Feige talents, magic tricks, which is, it all matters, it all counts. I'll include it all. I'm not trying to piss on any of it or try and push any of it under the rug. I'm not trying to elevate any of it. Each project, each movie, or each TV show, we will look at what we have, and what we have is all that's existed, and we will maybe find new riffs and new variations on that. But it all matters. And that makes viewers of all of it feel better. You know, you'll go, and I think this about Avengers Endgame, right? When they go and they revisit that scene in the Dark World, or that chunk, and like that movie, everyone shits on that movie. And that movie's bad, but Feige's like, no, that happened. That's canon. That matters.
Yeah.
And then you go, and then that bit in Endgame makes that movie feel more important, and you'll go back and watch it on Disney Plus, and you know, you'll keep your sub again the next month, and it all fits in.
All of this is true, apart from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which Feige clearly hates with a burning passion.
Coulson make canon.
Yeah, Coulson was in Captain Marvel. You know, Coulson. I think we'll see Clark Gregg again.
Yeah, pre Avengers, Coulson was in. It all
matters.
Marvel.
For Feige, it all matters.
From Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, because he would have made
Iron Fist.
What's her face? He would have made Laura Barton Mockingbird in the Hawkeye show if Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, that's fair.
It all matters. No, that happened. If Feige said that happened, it all matters.
It didn't. the multiverse is cracking open. We see kind of like shadows coming through. Was any of that recognizable to anyone, to Marvel nerds?
Just
shapes. So the multiverse is cracking open. Peter's like, okay, I thought of a sacrifice that would work. It was a nice character moment. I like ending this on a sacrifice for the character. That's something that does feel inherently Spider-Man to me. I'm gonna make this enormous sacrifice to make everyone else's lives better.
Yeah.
So that's really nice. The Doctor Strange casts a spell. Nobody knows Peter anymore. he has a conversation with MJ in the diner. She doesn't know him, and he decides not to reveal it. And then, yeah, he is now comic Spider-Man, and yeah, feels like he is set up to have another trilogy of films where, you know, hopefully he is hanging around New York this time. it's just the fourth one is called Spider-Man Home. And the fifth one is called Spider-Man Home Again. Spider-Man Still Home. That's
all the fourth one's called like Spider-Man West Coast, and we've had all this rock. he just moves immediately.
should we talk about the post-credit sequence?
Sure.
Or do we want to talk about grieving with Happy Hogan at the grave?
No, I think skip on from that.
So post credit scene. Do you think we see Happy again?
I thought this was. Are we actually? No, we're not talking about Happy. We're not talking about Happy. Nobody cares whether we see Happy again. Jon Favreau barely cares. Let's talk about Eddie Brock. I thought the post-credit scene was really funny. I talked to one of my friends about it, and he hated it. Where did you guys land?
I thought sort of pointless. I got a very clear sense that this was a late addition to Venom 2, and they went, oh, if we do this, we can do this in Spider-Man No Way Home. And Marvel went, listen, it's your contract, whatever. But I think...
Isn't it a funny character beat? Like, I say this, not as someone who. So when I realized he wasn't showing up in the movie itself, which I think I kind of had come to terms with that by the time the Spider-Man arrived, I was like, "We're not seeing Venom. We're just not seeing
him." I wasn't even thinking about it. to be honest.
Well, and I was like, I did. This was probably the one thing in the movie I predicted was like, we're gonna get a gag about him. Not quite turning up in time, and I thought the post credit scene was genuinely really funny.
It was funny enough. What I wanted from the post credit scene were Maguire and Garfield arriving back in their own universes and us getting to see what the changes are like. Properly cap that off. Show them getting home.
That would have cost a lot of money.
I mean, I think Kirsten Dunst had been available, maybe they'd have done it.
She's got no interest in doing this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I like the Venom scene because I think this was the most serious of the three Holland films, but especially by the end, the second half. And in a way, it made me appreciate the Venom 2 movies more, because when you go there into that sequence and you're like, oh God, those movies are just fun and they're silly. And all this MCU shit it takes itself much more seriously than these movies. And actually, I appreciate that there is this different tone that's out there. I really liked it.
Yeah, I liked it as a Venom scene. I can imagine if you were a Spider-Man viewer who didn't watch the Venom movies, you'd be like, "What the fuck is Tom Hardy doing here?"
Well, like the thing for me about this scene is that. It attempts to leave some symbiote in the Marvel Universe, right?
Well, yeah, that's
why. How is that going to work? What's it got to do with anything?
Well, so I think this is the real reason why probably the Marvel side of things were happy with this. They were going like,
now we have a Venom.
Yeah, we can use this as a tease for a future Spider-Man villain, and we can do Venom in this universe without having to. Be beholden to Tom Hardy's schedule.
Because I also think it's interesting that here's another prediction. I've made lots of predictions tonight, but I think that the bartender, he's not a complete nobody. Like that, he's in Ted Lasso. And I'm not saying that he would be the next Venom.
Danny Rojas. That's who it is.
Right. Football's live. Like he could be. You could see him.
No,
you
he's
could
not.
See him, that actor, that performer being infected by the symbiote and then sort of passed on to somebody else in the MCU. You disagree?
No way on earth is he. He's just a like a decent actor who was available that they could get into that scene to play.
Okay.
To play Obama, wherever. They cast, you know, whenever they do their Venom in the MCU, I don't know, it'll be. I don't know.
It'll be who?
I was trying to think of someone young. I couldn't. Someone. So it'll be.
Paddington.
It'll be Timothée Chalamet.
Paddington Venom would.
It'll be Timothée Chalamet. Oh, that's wow. Who it'll be.
Wonderful. What a guys. I'm going to guess. I'm trying to think of like the youngest actor I could possibly name.
Tremblay Venom.
Is that the youngest actor you could name?
Yeah.
The kid from Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, that little shit.
Yeah. Boss Baby? It could be Boss Baby.
What, Alec Baldwin?
No, the baby himself.
Race. Too soon.
Does anyone care? I don't care.
No. And then I thank you for revealing that the very last scene was a trailer for Doctor Strange, because that meant that I could leave after the mid credits.
Yeah.
So guys, that was Spider-Man. I still need to check No Way Home.
Yeah.
We did it.
Two things I just want to mention that we didn't mention.
Oh god.
Very, very small bits.
Mm-hmm.
When Andrew Garfield catches Zendaya and he says, "Are you okay?" And then he looks like he's about to cry and she says, "Are you okay?" And then I was about to cry. Because that really mattered for me. I loved it.
What I really liked about that was when she asked, "Are you okay?" And I thought, yeah, he is. He's about to get nominated for an Oscar for Tick, Tick, Boom.
I also like the way that James Gunn says, here's the thing we haven't talked about, the story that I haven't
just
told
that
you
one, that one second.
We haven't addressed this.
The other thing is it's when Andrew Garfield says to Tom Holland, nice catch, and Tom Holland says, "Nice throw." And I was like, that is a lovely little intertextual moment of him saying, "You have picked it up as Spider-Man well," and him saying back to him, "You did okay as well. You're both good guys."
I want to bring another moment like that.
That scene maybe would have played more accurately if Andrew Garfield had dropped it, Tom Holland had picked it up, and then they'd briefly held it together and went, "Well, at least it worked out okay in the end."
I also think "I love you guys" moment is really it felt lovely.
That was one of the kind of MCU undercutting moments that I didn't like, because it was like, "I love you guys," and the rest of them are like, "Okay, bit weird that you became that earnest in this moment." If they'd have gone,
"Joe,
we love
you genuinely,
you too." If they'd have gone back and said, "We love you too."
You're a cold bastard.
I think that moment in the film's a bit shitty. It's here is a moment where this Peter Parker is really earnest and the other two are like, maybe a bit too earnest, buddy.
It's not like they're having gay panic. Like,
no, they're not having gay. They're just
justifiably weirded out.
Yeah, which is the MCU thing. That's what the MCU does. And that is not a moment that you would have seen in the previous incarnations of Spider-Man. It's an MCU thing. It's an MCU thing, and I think it's fine. It plays in the MCU, but I felt
it's a Generation Z thing.
I felt more uncomfortable.
It's a Zoomer thing.
I felt
it's
more
a Zoomer
uncomfortable
thing, yeah.
about watching that happen to a character that wasn't an MCU character.
It's all the MCU now, though, man.
It is. Everything's all, the MCU. All...
Yeah, this is one of the points that I meant to make.
This podcast is the MCU right now. We're in
now
it.
When people say to me, "Where should I start my MCU watch?" I'm going to have to say, in 2001, there was a film by Sam Raimi called Spider-Man. You have to start with that.
God,
that's the first MCU Spider-Man film now.
To understand everything, that is where you must start.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to say, have you heard of the Canterbury Tales? Everything's the MCU, okay? Have you heard of Chaucer, maybe?
And then you watch A Knight's Tale.
and you go, oh, this Paul Bettany actor, he's Vision, right? Oh, fuck, yeah, right.
Yeah, shit.
Everything is the MCU.
It's a multiverse. one very brief moment that I want to ask about, just to carry this podcast on for a minute longer. Why the fuck do we get a close-up of a Star Wars Lego in this movie?
It's a callback. Callback to Spider-Man 1. It's Spider-Man 1, 3.
It's gross corporate stuff and I hate it.
Nah, come on. Of everything in this movie, that is the least Craven.
Yeah, there's worse shit.
Craven wasn't in it. Craven wasn't in it.
This whole movie exists to sell Spider-Man. This whole movie exists to sell Spider-Man DVD box sets.
Well, and it might sell...
And that's what you take issue with.
Might sell some Spider-Man Lego, some Star Wars Lego as well.
Yeah.
Some bullshit
Palpatine,
right there.
The Palpatine Lego piece is flying off the show. Hey, listen, with a $1 billion, you know, with selling $1 billion of ticket sales, there probably genuinely has been some kind of notable upsurge in Palpatine Lego pieces. That will be measurable. And bloody Bob Iger, or the new Bob, the replacement Bob, be counting those dollars.
What's the line? Somehow Palpatine has survived in Lego form. Somehow he's back.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Third Spider-Man.
Badass. If in Rise of Skywalker it was a Lego Palpatine, that would have been incredible. That would have been absolutely mad.
Right. Okay. So that was that was the final point of our Spider-Man No Way Home discussion. You know, lots of opinions available to hear. It was either a 5-star masterpiece, a 4-star great experience with quibbles, or a 2.5-star not as good after you've walked out.
Two and a half star. Come on.
Listen,
I stand by my Letterboxd. I'll say this to you. My Letterboxd profile bio is just half stars are for cowards. So just fucking pick one, dude.
No.
Is it two? Is it three? Pick one.
No.
Half stars are for cowards. Okay. Half stars for cowards.
Well, at the moment, it's two. It's 3 stars on my Letterboxd. But like I said, if I'd have put that in a couple of days later, it would have been 2.5. And I may yet edit it because I often do. I'll let you know when I slot it into the list of where it's ranked. Okay.
I'm privileged to hear.
This is one of 6 MCU movies I've given 5 stars. When I see it again, I will reevaluate whether it belongs above Endgame and Infinity War or below. I suspect number 6 is the right place for it.
What about The First Avenger? Does it?
The First Avenger?
Yeah.
What, you mean the
Captain
number...
America. First Captain America. Yeah,
the number 13 Marvel movie. You mean that one?
Oh, dear.
Number 13 out of 27.
Oh, dear.
Oh, knife to the heart. Oh, how does it stand against Eternals, the number 3 Marvel movie?
Number 3 from the bottom, you mean? Yeah.
It will be sliding in below Eternals for me.
Eternals is actually good.
Listen, there's a range of opinions are available, and we've given you them all on this podcast. And I'm listeners, I'm going to do you all a favor here. I'm going to make an executive decision that we're not doing a pitch because we need to go to bed.
You need
to stop listening.
I'm not prepared
to this podcast.
One so far,
and Reason's prepared one.
I had to go to bed. I had to go home. I have to go from where I'm recording to home an hour and a half ago. And I guess I have to stay here now. I have to stay where I am here.
That's fine. It's fine. Reese is recording from a phone box.
There's running water. There's light. I do have all I need. There's a
you're
bed,
the only reason
bedspread.
We're still doing this podcast now.
There's a cushion.
Okay, that was Spider-Man No Way Home. Thank you for listening.
I can survive this.
If you want to support us on Patreon, you can head to patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. Subscribe for $3 a month. We've just finished talking about Hawkeye on there, so go and listen to all our Hawkeye episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe on your podcast app of choice. You can find us on Twitter at @Cine_verse. Tell us which one of us is wrong. I'm assuming most of you will tell me that I am wrong. So direct those to at @JoeCunningham14. James is at James Hunt. And Reese is at Reese. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Our next episode is going to be The Copies, which we need to catch up on from last year, but we thought you'd probably want to hear our thoughts on
That's Spider-Man. What it's short for. Before
the catch-uppies will be here. They'll be the next main feed episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you then.
Goodbye.
Bye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.